Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by CLNS Media. Today on the show, it's a bit of a two-part episode. The first part is going to be on UCLA firing Steve Alford last night and some of the replacements they might come up with here. I thought this was an interesting topic that I can kind of actually provide a little bit of detail and light on, just because I live out here in LA and have gotten to know some people involved with the program. Second part of the podcast will be an NBA draft, you know, year-end look with Cole Zwicker. But first, I've got Rob Doster to talk UCLA. Rob, how's it going, buddy? You were up late last night on the East Coast.
Oh, yeah. I was. We all heard the rumors about this probably coming down at some point over the weekend, and they decided to do it at, what was it, 11 o'clock your time, I think, is when it finally became, maybe not official, but when the first reputable source had the information saying that it was done, the decision was made, and Steve Alford is now the former UCLA head coach. So I decided to go to sleep at about 1:35 and woke up this morning to an avalanche of notifications on my phone, which was, it's always good to see that at 8 o'clock in the morning when you wake up bleary-eyed and you look at your phone, it's like, you have 47 text messages. Oh, great.
So, it's kind of what happened with me, except I was awake whenever the whole thing happened. You and I and me and a bunch of other people and, you know, throughout the day, you were getting text messages saying, like, hey, there's a real chance this happens today. I am unsurprised that this happened on Sunday after the loss to Liberty on Saturday. You cannot lose in Pauly to Liberty with what the expectations of what that job are. And then you cannot bookend two losses in the state of Ohio and I guess Illinois, but they lost to Cincinnati and Ohio State by a combined 43 points. And then you bookend it with a loss to Belmont at Pauly. So this was coming. I mean, like, I feel like everyone around UCLA knew this was coming after the Liberty loss. They decided to cut bait. I get why. I totally understand why this is happening now. The way we're going to structure this is we're going to do 5 minutes on Steve Alford. We're going to do like a quick rundown of what the UCLA job is and why I don't think it's quite like the top five level job that some people do. And then we're going to talk about like who we think, what the future is basically for them. So, Rob, the first thing that I will ask you, what do you think of the UCLA tenure under Steve Alford here?
It is underwhelming, I guess, is probably the way to phrase it best. You know, they have three Sweet 16s, but I don't think any of those Sweet 16s were the kind of team where you were like, oh, you know what, this is a team that can make a lot of noise. That one of them was like, what, they were an 11 seed one year and they made it. They were another year, they beat like a 13 seed and a 12 seed to get to the Sweet 16. One year there was like a phantom goaltend. I forget exactly what it was, but
like, yeah, Bryce Alford like shot a three and they called a goaltending penalty on SMU. It was, I think it was Yannick Morera, the like 6'11" yes. center that they had.
That was a great pull, Yannick Morera.
Yeah, and they go through on like a weird goaltending call.
Yeah, and then the other Sweet 16 was the Lonzo Ball year, where it felt like they were going to be great, but they never decided to play any defense, and then Lonzo Ball got cooked by De'Aaron Fox in the Sweet 16, and here we are, Steve Alford. That was the pinnacle of the Steve Alford era. It was Lonzo Ball getting cooked by De'Aaron Fox in the Sweet 16.
So, like, I'll come back a little bit on the first year, right? Like, it was Ben Howland's players, and I think that needs to be notified, right? Like, they went 28-9, they won the Pac-12 tournament, and they go to the Sweet 16 and lose to a Florida team that ended up going to the Final Four and went 36-3 that year, right? Like, to me, that's probably what that year should have been for them, right? Especially coming off of what Howland had left. He obviously left a lot of players, went 25-10 in what they were. They made the NCAA tournament, lost to Minnesota the year that Howland got fired, right?
Yeah, and they won the Pac-12. I think he's the only high major coach to win their conference and then get fired.
Right. So the first year, I think they hit expectation, right? The second year, they go 22-14. They do make that run to the Sweet 16, but again, as we talked about with the Yannick Moreira pool, probably not quite what the UCLA fan base was hoping for. 2016 was an abject disaster. 2017 is the Lonzo Ball year. Lonzo kind of was awesome. That team was great. They end up losing to Kentucky, as you said, in the De'Aaron Fox game. If I remember correctly, they went like 15-3 and lost to an outlier good Arizona team in the Pac-12 race. So I'm actually pretty okay with that in terms of meeting expectations. Last year, they bring in a big recruiting class again. You know, they still have Aaron Holiday, who goes in the first round, Tom Welsh, who goes in the second round. So they have two draft picks, big recruiting class, and still go first four. Probably not meeting expectations. And obviously, this year, they didn't meet expectations. So really, I think if you're looking at it charitably, Steve Alford met expectations probably in two of the 6 years that he was there, right?
And even meeting those expectations, it wasn't like they had a great year. It was kind of the minimum right of what the expectations should be. Well, maybe his first year, that's a little bit unfair, saying that that's the minimum of what the expectations should be. But definitely with like once Lonzo Ball got there, nobody was thinking anything other than like this is a Final Four bound team. Like Steve Alford's figured it out. He's blah, 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 all that stuff. And they end up finishing outside the top 100 in defensive efficiency, can't stop anybody, don't win the conference, and get bounced out by Kentucky.
Right. So they had three first-round picks and two additional second-round picks on that team, plus Bryce Alford, who is, you know, for all of his warts, like destroying the G League right now. So in terms of like shooting the basketball. So like they had a lot of talent. Isaac Hamilton's in the G League, I believe, as well. So like they had the talent to be better than what they were. They lose to a Kentucky team that was good, but they probably should not have been a 3 seed. Probably should have been higher than that at the end of the day. You can probably make the case for the first year as well. They probably should have been a higher seed than what they ended up going into the NCAA tournament with. I think that a lot of the consternation with Steve comes back to there wasn't a lot of excitement about the hire when it happened. I don't think it was a majority of the fan base, but a very vocal minority that was bigger than what the typical vocal minority is, was not a fan of the hire. He exacerbated matters just straight up in his first year by starting Bryce Alford over Zach LaVine. Like, we can just be real and say that was probably a bad idea, right?
Yes, that's probably he lost some people at the start that never came back on board.
Right. And like, again, I'm someone who will defend Bryce Alford. He was a very good Pac-12 player. You don't start him over a guy who's averaging 25 points a night in the NBA right now. Right. Like,
no.
It just is what it is. I get why people look at the tenure and think he was just awful and a joke. I don't think it was that far. Like, I don't. I think that you go to three Sweet 16s, even under the expectations that there were. Two of them, I think, were legitimate Sweet 16s where, like, they actually performed up to expectations and did what they were supposed to do. It's hard for me to get behind being like, okay, this was, like, a total disaster of a tenure. But, look, I think it's pretty clear that he did not meet the standard of the UCLA job. And like, look, looking back, we probably should have expected that something like this. Like, to me, this was a median outcome for Steve Alford at this job. It just was never a great fit to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the best way to say it. He is, maybe it was a little bit too much of a job for him, if that makes sense. You know, I think he's a better fit at some place like in New Mexico or some place maybe a step or two below what a UCLA is, because I'm not convinced that he is the guy that you want coaching a bunch of five stars that are going to be there for 1 or 2 years, right? I think he's the guy you want kind of building up a program over 3, 4, 5 seasons with players that are going to be there for a while. I think that is a better fit for him as a basketball coach anything else. But at the end of the day, really what happened with this team in particular is one, and you could tell me if I'm wrong here, Sam, because I know that you're pretty close to that program, is one, I think that he put together a roster that just does not fit. It seems like what he kind of started to do on the recruiting trail, instead of going out to get guys that he wanted and worked with what he wanted to do, he started saying, okay, this is the most talented kid I can get. This is the best player in LA. This is the best four-star within, you know, 5 miles of our campus, and this is the best five-star that has any interest in our program. I'm going to get all these talented dudes, all these highly rated dudes, and see if we can figure it out. And right. It kind of bit him on the backside. And I don't know if it's something where with, like, Jalen Hands, look, talented dude. He could do some things on the basketball court. He is not a point guard. He is not a leader. He's not going to play any defense. He probably cares a little bit more about his draft standing than he does about UCLA winning. Chris Wilkes, not a great defender. Somebody that's more interested in his draft stock than UCLA winning. Moses Brown, not a great defender, not someone with a reputation for playing hard, not someone with a reputation for being a leader, somebody that probably cares a little bit more about his draft standing than UCLA winning. You put all that together with a group of guys that do not like that. I had one source close to the program tell me that the team, quote, hated him, meaning Alford. So you put all that together, and this is kind of what you get. So if I understand why UCLA made the move that they did. You know, the Pac-12 was terrible. There's enough talent on this roster to make a run and win a league title if it all kind of comes together. I don't think it's all going to come together. I don't know who they have on that staff that the players would actually play for. I'm not convinced that Murray Bartow is the guy that they are going to play for. And actually, this was an interesting point. I had I was talking with Jeff Goodman of Stadium earlier, and he said part of the reason that they made this change when they made it was because they didn't want to take the risk that Steve Alford would get these guys to figure it out. Yeah. All these talent on the play, all the talent on this roster would come together, and then they would make the run to win the Pac-12 or get an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament, and then they'd be forced to keep Alford for another season.
So yeah, I'll kind of address a lot of that. And I'm trying to like figure out my brain where to start. I think I'll start with the recruiting side. So I think that what happened was, and I fell into this trap in terms of like commending it and thinking it was like a good thing that was happening at the time. I think they started recruiting off of rankings instead of recruiting for scheme. And I was certainly like, I wrote like a big thing on like them turning around on the recruiting trail and like David Grace playing a huge role in this. I think if you look back, maybe if you ask Alford in 5 years, the thing that he might regret most was hiring David Grace on this staff. And I think that you look at the fact that Grace obviously was let go at the end of last season. You know, you look at the players that he brought in. He brought in a lot of the Compton Magic kids, right? Jalen Hand specifically is one of them. I believe Jules Bernard was a Compton Magic kid as well. You can look through Jalen Hill. TJ Leaf was a Compton Magic kid, although he committed to Arizona originally. So, like, this was kind of a miss until Sean Miller decided to not take him on that. It was like a U18 team. And then TJ decided to go play for Israel in that tournament. So, like, you can look through a lot of kind of different – Ike Onabogu's another guy, didn't really have, like, a crazy impact. I think that you can look through this and say, like, hey, just through who Grace's connections were with, you know, he was a former coach with the Compton Magic. It made sense to kind of go down this road and get kids, but – at the end of the day, they weren't the right kids for UCLA's scheme. You mentioned like guys kind of playing for their draft stock. I think Wilkes is pressing right now for sure. I think Jalen Hands thinks he's a pro. He's just not a good basketball player, in my opinion. Moses Brown, I will say, like, I think Moses genuinely plays hard. I think that he is actually someone who tries and seems to care and seems to, I don't know if he like full on gets it, but I think that he is someone that is not necessarily as singularly focused on his future as he is the team's future. But Jalen Hands is like the poster child of all this, I think. Like, Jalen Hands is like, he has the seventh best assist rate in all of college basketball right now. That's fool's gold because he dribbles around the perimeter constantly and just like totally breaks off from what they're trying to do every time, turns the ball over consistently and can't hit a shot to save his life. He doesn't like contact. If you hit him like with a screen, he tries to avoid contact going into the basket, so he never takes free throws. He's just not a good basketball player. That's why I don't think this is going to turn around. The Tiger Campbell injury to me is like seriously a moment where we look back and say, this is where Steve Alford might have, maybe not where Steve Alford got fired, but it's the moment where it became a very real possibility Steve Alford was going to be gone this year because they had no backup point guard and Jalen Hands then just could do whatever he wanted and they had no recourse.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think we talked about that when it happened, was that they didn't really have a guy that could step in and do what Tiger Campbell was going to do. Like, Tiger Campbell, he's not Chris Paul, you know? Like, we're not talking, like, he's what, like a top 50-ish kind of player? Like, he's going to be a good point guard in the Pac-12, assuming he comes back healthy. But what he's a steadying presence that took the ball out of hands, and allowed him to play off the ball and kind of just created like a leader on the floor and a presence on the floor that they don't really have. And now what you're doing is you're asking a guy who is wired to be a scorer and a playmaker and a creator to go out there and kind of like run an offense. And that's just not what Jalen Hands does. And, you know, so much of what basketball, so much of building a team with talented players is putting these players in the position that is best for them to succeed. And the problem is, like, that's just not happening with this group. It just isn't working. And then you combine that with the fact that, you know, they don't want to play defense and they quit on the coach and they're more worried about things other than winning. Like, and by put the all way, that like, together and this is what happens.
I do think that this team is like totally tuned out, Alford, from talking to people around there. Like,
there's no question. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think
no
they
question.
Were done. Like, no question. They were done. Just like the last thing on Alford, I guess we should look at this from his perspective. I think he takes this job again, like say that he knows what the future is and he has a chance to stay at New Mexico or go to UCLA. I still think he takes this job like 100 times out of 100 and goes to UCLA, deals with all of the everything that happened from banners flying over, asking to fire him and like dealing with all of the nepotism allegations and everything. Just all of that. Like, I think that he still does this because UCLA is still, it's still like the premier job. Like, it's still a premier job, I will say, not the premier job, but it is still such a premier job that I think you want to test yourself on that level.
So, I mean, I guess this is a good segue for where we are going next in this conversation, but I don't necessarily think that the way it currently stands, it is a premier job because they're not investing the money in it that they need to invest. Let me put this into context. Steve Alford makes made $2.6 million per year at UCLA living in Westwood. Konzo Martin at Missouri makes $3 million a year. Will Wade in Baton Rouge makes $3 million a year. Avery Johnson in Tuscaloosa makes $2.9 million a year. Mike Bray makes more than what Steve Alford makes living in South Bend, Indiana. Like, the list goes on and on and on and on. If you're going to want, like, if you want to go get an elite coach, you have to pay elite and you have to pay the premium because of the fact that the cost of living in LA is out of this world. Sam, you know, you live in LA. Like, it's very, very difficult to be able to find a way to, like, live somewhere close to something that where you're able to afford to pay the rent and pay the food and pay the restaurants and do all of that while living on, like, a salary of whatever it is. Now, imagine you're a basketball coach and you have the choice between, like, going out and getting a job at a powerhouse program in Bloomington, Indiana, where you can go for like $1 million, get everything that you could possibly dream of in a house, whereas like $1 million in LA is going to get you what, like 3 bedrooms and 2.5 baths?
Yeah, that's about right, honestly, in terms of like real estate. In terms of what this job is, so I think UCLA fans think it is on the level of Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina, like those schools. I would say it's not right now because of what you said. So you mentioned putting money back into the program. So the good news is like that they just built this great facility, the Mo Austin Center, right on campus for basketball players, right? It is their new basketball facility for the men's and women's team. The only reason that really happened was because like guys like Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love like gave back to the program and like gave them money to build something like this. You look at the fact that they don't charter flights. Like, it is insane to me that a program like UCLA does not charter flights. Like, Gonzaga charters all of their flights.
Dayton charters flights. Dayton. Wichita State charters flights.
Right.
UCLA can't charter flights. And to put this into context, like, I'm sure people listening to
this is like the most, like, yeah. Coach,
right. But think about it like this, dude. How much does it suck for, like, a random 6-foot guy to sit in a coach seat on a Southwest flight? Now imagine that, one, you are a 7-foot basketball player. Two, you're a 7-foot basketball player that just played 35 minutes of high intensity basketball, right? It's 1 o'clock in the morning by the time you're getting on the flight. You just had to spend however many hours in the airport waiting to actually board that flight. Now you have to go sit in the middle seat next to like that fat, sweaty guy and somebody that doesn't know how to share the elbow rest. And imagine being Moses Brown and having to sit in there.
Right.
I was talking to one coach that actually said that what they do when they don't charter flights is whoever leads the team in rebounding, they get those exit rows. And then after that, everybody else is kind of it's up to them and to sit like in whatever coach seat they're going to end up getting stuck in. Imagine being 7-footer just playing a basketball game, getting stuck in the middle seat on a Delta flight. And this is at the same time where we have all these studies coming out about how important it is for athletes to like get a certain amount of sleep and, you know, how bad overnight flights are for NBA players and all this other kind of stuff. We're doing this to college kids and you're expecting to win. And it's not necessarily expecting to win, expecting to compete at the same level as 100 other programs that actually do charter these flights. It's just not going to happen. And it hurts you in recruiting. If you are a kid, imagine if you're a 5-star, you can go anywhere you want in the world. You can go to UCLA where you're going to be playing in front of a half full building of people that show up an hour late because getting anything done in LA on time is simply impossible because of how spread out it is and how much traffic there is. And the fact that they'll have 9 p.m. Eastern time tips, 6 p.m. local time tips and expect people that work a 9-to-5 to be able to get there just doesn't work that way. Imagine that. Versus like going to see Cameron Indoor Stadium, knowing that you're getting like you might get your own private jet based on what Duke's budget is for flying all over the place. So you put it into context like that, and all of a sudden it's a much different story. It's not necessarily what the player should get. It's if you want to be an elite program and compete at that level, you have to invest the money that the other elite programs are investing.
Yeah, and they just haven't been willing to do that. Also, the administration is difficult to deal with. You look at the fact that UCLA fans don't have faith in Dan Guerrero to like make a great hire in this scenario. They probably shouldn't, to be honest, given what his track record is of coaches. Like Jim Mora did not work out well. You look at the fact that fan expectations like play a critical role here, right? The fact that they wanted to run Alford out of the job after two Sweet 16s in 3 years, most schools would be very happy with that, right? Like even given the circumstances of that second one, like most schools would be like, okay, this is fine. Alford's doing what we expected. That's not the way it is at UCLA. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I don't think that is an unfair thing for them to hold over a coach, but it's a reality. Like it just kind of lords over everything there. It is a difficult job that is not for everyone at all there.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And again, look at you coming up with these segues, man. It's almost like you're a podcast host. So I guess what that means is, where are you looking when it comes to replacing Steve Alford? Because I think there are probably 6 names that are going to show up on every single one of these lists. And let's just get this out of the way. You ain't getting Billy Donovan. You ain't getting Jay Wright. You're probably not going to go out and hire Chris Beard because that's a weird fit. You're probably not going to go out and hire Kevin Keats, which is a weird fit. So there are like 6 names that everyone's going to put on every single list.
Okay, so I will say this. I think that their first, like the first guy that they want is Billy Donovan, I bet.
And you're not getting him.
What I've been told. I do not think that happens, but I think that is the guy that they want.
They want Billy Donovan and I want to drive a McLaren.
Right. Maybe neither like this really.
You want to know why neither of them are happening? Because you can't afford it.
Right. Like they would genuinely have to pay Billy Donovan probably $6 to $6.5 million. And we have no track record of UCLA being willing to do that. Like maybe they are. Maybe some crazy donor is willing to do this. I don't know if they are.
Here's what I don't get. Why do they need a donor? You have a $280 million contract with Under Armour. Where is that money going?
Chip Kelly's pocket, baby.
And that's what? Like that's like a third of what they get per year that he's there, right?
I know. Where's the next going? So the next guy that everyone brings up is Fred Hoiberg. Hoiberg was obviously fired this season by the Chicago Bulls. He was at Iowa State for many years, was incredibly successful. He's 46, so he's young. He's not necessarily like vibrant. He's very quiet and low-key. It's not really like Hollywood to me in a lot of ways. Like they'll play a very up-tempo, exciting offensive scheme. But the other thing that I think a lot of people haven't really been noting with this is, like, Fred Hoiberg built Iowa State based off of getting transfers. Fred Hoiberg doesn't really like recruiting. Like, that's just real, right? Like, he has said many times himself, he doesn't really like recruiting. It's basically impossible to get transfers into UCLA. Their academic standard for accepting transfers is crazy difficult. So you can work around that, but, like, I think it's a questionable fit because of that.
Here's what I would say to that. I think Hoiberg is a very, very smart coach, and I think he understood that when you are at Iowa State, you have to do things differently than if you are at a program like UCLA. I think he realized that his best chance for getting players that could win at that level was to find a couple hidden gems and then surround them with players like, like a Bryce DeJean Jones, who flamed out of UNLV and was he at UCLA? No, USC? Go and find these second chance guys.
Go get DeAndre Kane.
Yes, go get players like Deontay Burton. Go get players like that are second chance guys that didn't work out at their first job or at their first school, and that's probably your best bet. At UCLA, I think he's smart enough to realize he doesn't need to do that, you know? Here's the other thing. I don't think he really needs to go out and recruit either. Like, you got to show up at certain places every once in a while to be that face, but you go and you hire the guys that can get you somebody, right?
So here's what makes that more complicated right now, though. USC is going to get basically all of the Compton Magic kids right now because they hired Eric Mobley, and they have the Mobleys committed, the brothers, Isaiah and Evan. Evan is like one of the two or three best high school players in the entire country. I would venture that from 2019, 2020, and probably 2021, they probably get most of the Compton Magic kids, which makes the job at UCLA more difficult than it should be in terms of recruiting.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I don't necessarily think that you only have to get Compton Magic kids to be able to succeed at UCLA, and I think that there is something to just being able to recruit to that brand if the program's in better shape than what it is. Like, if you look at some of the guys that they've gotten, like Shabazz Muhammad was from Las Vegas, Kyle Anderson's from New Jersey, Jordan Adams is from Georgia.
Kevon Looney was like, I think he was like tangentially connected to the Magic, but like he's from Milwaukee.
Yeah, and you know, even guys that are on the roster now, Jalen Hands is obviously from LA, but Chris Wilkes is an Indiana kid. Moses Brown is, I believe, he's New York City, right?
New York City, yeah.
So you don't have to just recruit from LA. So I get that. I know it'll make it harder. But I, like I said, I think if Fred Hoiberg takes the job, I think he's smart enough to hire somebody that is going to be able to get him the players that he needs.
I agree. And I think, like, genuinely Hoiberg there, it's not a great fit, but I think it's a fine fit to work there. At UCLA. Like, I don't think anyone would write the column, this is a bad idea, if they hire Fred Hoiberg. I think a lot of people would actually write that it's a good idea. And
I mean, I wouldn't call it a home run hire, but based off of what I think they're going to be willing to invest and based off of the financial limitations that the program puts on itself, it might be the best you could do. And it's not bad.
Yeah. And, like, by the way, Fred Hoiberg got a whole lot of money from the Chicago Bulls. So, like, maybe you don't have to go insane in terms of salary. Maybe you do, though. Who knows? So the next guys, Earl Watson is a name that comes up. He coached the Phoenix Suns. He was, like, I thought he was bad when he was the Phoenix Suns coach. Like, I genuinely thought they elevated him. So what happened was they elevated him to an assistant role. And then, like, later that year, they gave him the head coaching job. I don't think he was ready for that job yet. I think that his best bet is to just, like, get another job first and then try and come back to UCLA. Because obviously he would love to coach UCLA. It's where he went. I would not hire Earl Watson based off of his track record if I was UCLA.
Yeah, I mean, I get the connection. UCLA alum, former NBA coach, already connected with Under Armour, but I think you're exactly right. I don't necessarily think he's ready for that job. As one Pac-12 coach put it to me, he would just be another unaccomplished Pac-12 head coach.
The name that comes up a lot is Eric Musselman. From what I've been told, the UCLA pool of people that will be making the decisions are not as high on him as what you would think. I think he's an awesome coach. I think he's a culture builder. I think that he would do very, very well there.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that for two reasons. One, like, if we're worried about the transfer thing with Hoiberg, like, that's Eric Musselman on steroids, right? He's much more
sure.
But
Musselman has a background of recruiting, though, in a way that Hoiberg sure. really doesn't.
Former NBA coach, and like he's been an assistant that was tasked with getting players. Like, I get that, makes sense to me. I don't necessarily think it's a deal breaker. What I do think might be a deal breaker is the fact that let's put it like this: he's a little bit too intense. You talk to people that have worked for him, you talk to people that have played for him, and he is a bit of a screamer, can be a bit grating, and there's a reason why he has so much staff turnover. I just don't know if that's necessarily. When you're coming off of two coaches that have rubbed people the wrong way, that were hated by either AAU coaches or the players on his own team, I don't necessarily know if Musselman is the right way to go to follow that up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Some of the other random names that, like, I've gotten from the occasional person, like, people think they'll call Tony Bennett. If I was Tony Bennett, I would not take that job. Like, I mean, set up at Virginia.
You have to call Billy Donovan. You have to call Tony Bennett. You have to call Jay Wright. You have to make those three calls. And here's the problem. I think this is the biggest situation with UCLA right now, is that you can make those calls, but you ain't getting them. And if the coach of Virginia is saying no to the UCLA job, that tells you all you need to know about what you're paying, what you're investing into the program, and where you currently are.
Yeah, and like I've heard, I think that Goodman said Mike Bray, right?
It makes sense, right? He's at another high academic institution. He's at an Under Armour program. That's definitely a name that I heard outside of what Goodman said, and it's not one that I think is. I think it would be a very, very good hire for UCLA. I don't necessarily think that it's something that Mike Bray would take, and that's mainly because of the money involved and some of the expectations that come with what is limited investment into the program. Like, it would take a lot. I think it would take a statement of, like, we're getting charter flights, we're going to charter recruiting everywhere, and you're going to get, like, a pay raise from what you're currently making at Notre Dame.
Parrish and Norlander are good friends over at the Ion College Basketball Podcast. Shout out that podcast that I used to be a sort of part of occasionally whenever I would get words in. They mentioned Rick Pitino as like someone that Parrish speculatively, not based off of like information or anything, would consider. I cannot see Pitino getting past the background check of UCLA, so I would just not like even spend time on that really.
This is the way that I would phrase it. If you could hire Rick Pitino, you go hire Rick Pitino.
Yeah.
I don't think that you can hire Rick Pitino. He's without a doubt, without question, with zero argument, I don't even think there's any way that you would disagree with me on this. He is flat out the best basketball coach that they can go get.
Right.
And if they got him, you immediately hire a guy that is a top five coach in the sport. He's going to turn that program around. Maybe he only stays 5, 6, 7 years, but he will get you back to what you want UCLA to basketball to be. I don't know if you can do it. I don't know if there's a show cause coming in 2 years. There's just too many question marks. I don't even know. Like, I don't think that it can get done. But if I'm UCLA AD, I do everything I can to try and get him, because I think he is without a doubt the best guy you can get. And I mean, he'll say yes. And he'll say yes to like whatever cut rate salary you offer.
Guys, I have not been told, but I think are excellent people that they should reach out to. Chris Holtman. Chris Holtman's buyout at Ohio State is apparently just fucking insane.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't have a buyout. It's guaranteed.
Yeah, like he would.
I talked to a source that would know, and he is his contract is guaranteed. It's fully guaranteed. He has I think it's 8 years, $24 million or something like that, and it's fully guaranteed.
Yeah. So like, if he leaves that job, he has to pay Ohio State like an insane amount of money. At least within the first 4 years, from what I was told.
Think about that. If it's fully guaranteed. Right. And I'm pretty sure that means that you have to pay it, which is what is that like? He's in the second year of his deal. Like, you basically have to pay $18 million to Ohio State to hire him or something like that. You're not doing it.
I've not been told Kevin Keats, but I think Keats is like a star. He's awesome. I would be surprised if they go that direction, but I think he's genuinely very good. Same with Chris Beard. Keats plays more up tempo, so I think he fits UCLA a little bit better. Beard is, Beard's teams are tough to watch, and I think UCLA fans would hate that. But again, I think Chris Beard is one of the 10 best coaches in the sport. I would strongly consider this.
And I think I love both of those two guys. Two other names I would put in that same conversation are Buzz Williams and Mick Cronin as guys that are very, very good basketball coaches that I don't think fit what UCLA would be. And like with Chris Beard, like if I'm him, there's no way that I leave Texas Tech for anything other than Texas when Shaka Smart inevitably moves on from there. That's the only job that I leave Texas Tech for.
So the guy that I've been told the most, the guy whose name I've gotten the absolute most about the UCLA job is Jamie Dixon, which is very weird to me given the Ben Hallen connection. Like he was Ben Hallen's protege at Pitt, replaced him at Pitt, and like could that be the trajectory again? Could he essentially replace Ben Hallen at UCLA? Dixon is from like the Hollywood area, very sharp guy, very offensively inclined in terms of his coaching style. They play a little bit slower, but I think that would be okay. You look at his TCU teams, they've gotten up and down the court once they get point guards pretty well. It is something that I think is worth noting. Like if you made me pick who gets this job right now, and I don't know, like it's so early, it's literally not even 2019 as we're recording this. This job will not like be hired until probably the end of March. So like so many things can change. I think if you made me give a pick right now, I think I would say Jamie Dixon.
It might be like, I get it. Southern California, his family's still there. He makes a ton of money at TCU though. I don't know if UCLA can afford to pay what it's going to take to get him from there. He's also at his alma mater, and I'm sure that that matters. And like things are kind of trending up for him right now at TCU in terms of the investment that they have coming into that program and the amount of talent that's like kind of in that Dallas and Texas area. So I get it. All the dots connect. I don't know if I necessarily see it happening. And if I'm the one making that decision, I go Patino first, and then I think I would lean towards Hoiberg over Jamie Dixon. But I don't hate it. There's the Jamie Dixon one. Like there's no glitz or glamour to it, but I think it'd be a fine hire.
Yeah. I think that's all I got. If you were to rank UCLA within this ecosystem of college basketball, I would say like top 10 job, not a top 5 job, right? maybe top 15, something like that. Like if they were willing to make the commitment of resources, it is 100% a top 10 job. Without that commitment, it's more difficult to say. Like I think there's a reasonable case you would rather have, like, for instance, Shaka Smart got brought up a ton of times with the UCLA job last time. I think you would rather have Texas because the expectations are lower, the amenities are better, and you can get, like, you can be just as good at Texas as you can be at UCLA, given the recruiting, given all of the advantages you have.
I mean, I firmly believe that Texas is the best job in the country that isn't Duke, Kansas, North Carolina, Kentucky, Indiana. Yeah. I think that Texas is the best job. It's not one of those five. The only reason I don't put UCLA among those five, it's the salary that they pay, the cost of living in LA, the fact that it's tough to deal to like to navigate the Los Angeles recruiting world. That's not necessarily something that's ideal for anybody. It is not that you look at those five programs I mentioned, you compare their home court to what UCLA's home court is, not necessarily ideal either. And like the investment into the program beyond just what the salary is, you know, are you going to get charter flights? I mean, it really comes, it sounds weird to like base the decision on charter flights, but I think it really is just kind of like a statement to what UCLA basketball, what they're willing to put into the program. If they're not willing to invest for what it takes to get charter flights, if they're not willing to pay that, then do they really want to be an elite basketball program? I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I think that's right. Rob, we're done here. After a quick little ad break, we will go to Cole's Wicker and we'll talk about the NBA draft. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, before we get to Cole's Wicker, I've got a couple advertisements for you. RX Bar, they want to build things the right way. They believe in the power of transparency, and they let their core ingredients do all of the talking with them. They are obviously a whole food protein bar. What that means is they're made with real whole ingredients. You would recognize RX Bar at the shelf. They're the ones that have egg whites for protein, dates to bind, and nuts for texture. Then other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spice. Like sea salt or cinnamon. It turns out these real food ingredients taste great. They're great for a number of occasions, breakfast on the go, snack at the office. You throw them in the bag for a plane ride. I'll be doing a decent amount of traveling here, scouting coming up at the beginning of the year. I'm excited to have RX Bar, and they come in 14 delicious flavor varieties. Mango, pineapple, chocolate, hazelnut, everything from mint chocolate, which is my favorite, all the way to seasonal flavors as well. And they also have RX Nut Butter, which contains a few simple and similar ingredients like egg whites, fruits, and nuts. Each single-serve packet contains delicious, creamy nut butter with 9 grams of high-quality protein. It's squeezable and spreadable and pairs great with fruit, rice cakes, pretzels, or straight out of the pouch. I personally am a big fan of RX Bar. I think that they are just the easiest way to have a quick meal on the go that is healthy and protein-based. For 25% off your first order of the bestseller variety pack, visit rxbar.com/gametheory and enter that promo code GAMETHEORY, GAMETHEORY, at checkout. This is valid in the United States only and for a limited time, but go to rxbar.com/gametheory and get that great variety pack that will allow you to taste a lot of different types of RX bars. Our second sponsor today is Simple Contacts. You guys know that I love Simple Contacts. I'm gonna have to do a quick reorder of Simple Contacts in the new year because my contacts are running out from the last time that I ordered Simple Contacts. It's the most convenient way to renew your contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of contacts from anywhere in minutes. Instead of heading to the doctor year after year just to renew your prescription for something you wear every day, you can do it on your own time and terms in just a few minutes. This truly is vision care for the 21st century. It's convenient, fast, reliable. It's a 5-star experience. It offers choice, and it's going to save you money because that vision test is only $20. An appointment without insurance costs up to $200. The contact lens prices are unbeatable. Standard shipping is free, and best of all, I'm offering a promotion to our listeners here. You know, just go to simplecontacts.com/gametheory20. You're going to get $20 off your contacts order. When you go to simplecontacts.com/gametheory20 and enter that code GAMETHEORY20 at checkout, it's really just a fantastic product. I am a huge fan of Simple Contacts. As I've been saying to you for a long time on this show, I really believe in this product. This is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. They only test that your current prescription still helps you see 20/20, and they renew that prescription. They don't write completely new scripts or examine eye health, but go to simplecontacts.com/gametheory20 and enter that code at the checkout, and you're going to get $20 off your contacts order. Now to Cole's Wicker. Cole, how you doing, man? We're going to talk about a variety of topics here. We're going to talk really quickly at the top about what Rob and I talked about with UCLA, because you've watched them a couple times. And then we're going to move on to a few interesting topics, just like kind of around the NBA right now. We're going to talk about Dennis Smith and his role in Dallas. We're going to talk about the Patrick McCaw deal quickly. And then we're going to kind of do a theoretical discussion on if we're undervaluing bigs on rookie contracts, like late in the first round, potentially, where you can get them super cheap. And then finally, we're going to just jump into an end of year 2018 review as it refers to the 2019 draft. Who are some of the guys that have really risen up our boards over the course of the last little while? Cole, how you doing, man?
Doing well. It's kind of an interesting day. Went to the Seahawks game yesterday, end of the NFL regular season. That was a bittersweet experience. Seahawks played freaking terrible, probably the worst sporting event I've ever been to live, so that's interesting. It's also great to have fantasy football off of the timeline. I don't know, man, I'm not a huge fan of fantasy football Twitter, just all everybody talking about their teams all the time. So now it's like straight NBA, straight college basketball, a little bit of NFL playoffs, so getting into the better time of the year.
Yeah, I finished third in my fantasy football league with the Athletic this year, so I'm feeling pretty good about it. But I'm excited for it to be. I'm excited for it to be done. Not gonna lie to you. Let's talk about UCLA really quickly. We'll focus here on just like the prospects on UCLA because there are a lot of guys on this team that think they're pros. My guess is that they're not pros. Let's start with the guy that I kind of have now trashed on like multiple podcasts today. Jalen Hands. I don't think Jalen Hands is good at basketball. Do you think Jalen Hands is good at basketball?
I do not. No. I mean, some of his pull-ups last year got me kind of intrigued. He took some deep range, like 28, 30 footers, but I don't think the guy thinks the game at a high level. I just don't know what you're doing with a prospect like that. I don't like his decision-making. According to other reports, there's been some attitude issues there too. So I don't consider him a prospect. Like, he's nowhere near my top 60. I mean, maybe like top 120 or something. If you get down far enough, you're going to encounter like some athletic traits, and some of the pre-college basketball pedigree maybe factors in a little bit at that stage, but I'm not really interested.
So he pounds the ball constantly on the perimeter. His assist rate is good. Like, I think that it mostly has to do with the fact that he dribbles 67 times before handing the ball off. He is a terrible defender. He is maybe one of the five worst perimeter defenders in college basketball. He's so bad. Can't perform anything that they need in their scheme. 40% from two-point range this year. I thought the three-point shooting last year was like slightly a mirage. He shot 37% on 115 attempts. This year he's at 31% on 67 attempts. Honestly, like you said, like maybe 120. He would not even be near my top 120 right now. I don't think he is someone that I want on my basketball team. Maybe it's a bad situation, but whatever. Chris Wilkes is a guy that I had as a first rounder coming into the year, and I do not have that now. Bad true shooting percentage at 53% for what he is. Low assist rate, just doesn't really pass the ball at a super high level. Never really has. He shot 35% from three last year, 34% this year. I think he can sort of shoot, albeit inconsistently, but I think he needs to do a better job of finishing inside to become like a genuine, true potential, like real prospect, as well as do a better job of defending.
Yeah, I don't like his archetype is kind of like a difficult shot maker. You'll see him, some of his tape, he does have that high release, so he can hit some difficult shots off the dribble. Just conceptually and aesthetically, he kind of reminds me a little bit of Middleton. I don't think he's anywhere near as good, obviously, but that is going to be the kind of player he's going to have to be in the NBA to win that way. And I just don't think he's anywhere near that caliber of shooter. I mean, his stats aren't that great as far as his shooting ability. I do think maybe on tape it's a little bit better. And if you're, you know, second half of the second round, maybe you invest in someone like that, a wing who can get his own shot at times. I agree. The athleticism concerns are stark there. He's not a bouncy athlete. He's more, again, of a difficult one-on-one shot maker who can make shots off the dribble. I'm not sure how intrigued I am. I had him top of the second round coming into the year. I would probably have him latter half of the second right now.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I have him at like 50 right now. I think if he comes out, he probably gets drafted. I'll be honest. Like, I do think a team will take a shot on a guy who's 6'8", with like a 7-foot wingspan, who could be like an actual wing and who has potential to shoot it. Any interest in Moses Brown?
From what I've seen, no. As you can tell, I haven't seen a ton of UCLA this year, frankly, just because I'm not that interested in the Pac-12 overall. The Pac-12 has been horrendous this year outside of Arizona State, and I just don't – I think I've seen two games of UCLA at the beginning of the year, and Moses Brown did not interest me that much at this time. I just don't believe in the shooting mechanics at all. He's a developmental big. We're gonna get into this a little bit with this NBA discussion, how you value bigs, getting him on a contract. I think Moses Brown is a little bit too developmental, and I don't see the upside as like an impact starter to invest that kind of capital in. He looks more like a second contract guy to me.
Yeah, I think that he should stay in school and continue to develop. He's an awesome offensive rebounder. He is very skinny and like isn't necessarily like a full-on position establisher, but I'm often surprised by how deep he gets post position sometimes. Like, I would expect him to never be able to do it, and like he kind of does it sometimes, and it like gives me hope that just he's strong and like wiry strong in a way. Reports I've gotten are that like he actually does listen to like the coaches there and like wants to be good. So I think that that's a positive. Like, I think he should just stay in school and deal with whoever the new coach is. Cause I don't like right now, he'd be a guy that I think would get a two-way contract. And that's just not, and like I wouldn't sign him to a two-way contract, but I think some organization would sign him to a two-way contract.
Yeah, that's fair. And honestly, I just feel if you're a big and you do that, I just don't know what the guarantee is that you're ever going to find like a solidified roster spot. I would stay in school and kind of continue to hone your skills because bigs are so replaceable. Like if you're like a I don't think his upside is tremendous from what I've seen. And he's a high variance prospect. So our team's really going to invest in a big like that.
Yeah, I agree. Cody Riley, Jules Bernard, Chris Smith, Jalen Hill, David Singleton, anything?
Chris Smith was kind of intriguing last year. He wasn't ready. He got kind of sterling reports. I think the ESPN guys were tweeting about him a little bit. I didn't see it on the floor. He definitely wasn't ready, so I'm glad he stayed in school. Cody Riley, I saw in person when he played on Marvin Bagley's high school team. I mean, he's a beast. Like, I saw him and I was like, okay, this guy might be like poor man's Julius Randle, but I haven't really seen him play much, honestly. I don't think any of those guys are really real prospects right now.
Yeah, I think they should all stay in school, to be honest. Like, I'm just at the stage where, like, I think it's better for them to stay around and, like, try and improve their games. Yeah, to me, Wilkes is the only guy that I think is a real prospect at this stage. Jalen Hance, to me, was the worst NBA draft combine invite since I've been doing this, which says a lot. I honestly am not sure he's a Pac-12 level point guard. I'm not even there. Let's move on. I think we've spent enough time on UCLA on this podcast. It's a 7-6 team that certainly has a lot of pedigrees we talked about with Rob, but not necessarily a great spot right now, obviously, given the fact that they're making a coaching change. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Patrick McCaw? Do you want to start with Dennis Smith? What are you thinking?
Let's do Patrick McCaw real quick.
Okay, so you're a big Patrick McCaw. Well, let me rephrase. You were a big Patrick McCaw fan coming into the draft. You liked him after his rookie year. Where are you right now as he signs a 2-year, $6 million deal, $3 million a year to go play for the Cleveland Cavaliers? And the second year is going to be non-guaranteed. I assume at this stage that the first year is going to get guaranteed because the guarantee date is on January 7th. And like, I don't think the Cavs would have done this like purely only as a favor to Bill Duffy. I think that they're anticipating keeping him.
For sure, yeah. I think it's a low-risk move. I mean, there's no investment here. They could technically waive him before the guarantee date if they really wanted to, but I agree with you. I think they're going to give him the rest of the season just as a platform to assess his ability. I think there is some intrigue here as a kind of a 1-2 point of attack defender, very quick, with great, great hands. He's very good at getting steals. He was that way in college as well, but very skinny, and the shooting confidence has never really gotten there. That's why I don't think he fit well in Golden State eventually, because he wouldn't take those threes. He'd pass up on shots, try to drive. He's not really an adept slasher at this stage. He's got pretty good IQ. I think he makes some pretty good decisions as a passer. He's not a primary or even a secondary. He's more of a very tertiary handler, but I would like to see him get more of an opportunity. So I think on a team like Cleveland, who obviously they're a bottom five team in the league, what's the downside risk to this?
Nothing. I don't think it's anything. They still had a little bit of their mid-level exception left over. Actually, I think they might have had it all left over now that I think about it. So this is like a no risk, no opportunity cost move even for them, in my opinion. So he's not really a trade asset at all, because if I remember, like, he might be a trade asset, but like, he doesn't count against any sort of salary if they were to trade him this summer, right? Because of the way this is set up?
Yeah, the new rules, it's not like J.R. Smith, which was grandfathered into the new CBA. So there's very big trade complications because it counts on your non-guaranteed salary.
Right. So this is them just purely giving him a four-month trial, I think. And I agree with you. Yes. I think it's a home run move for them, because any time that you can get a semi-proven, I guess, like, not really fully proven, but like sort of proven wing for $3 million and you get a cost controlled year after that, I think it's worthwhile. Like, if you told me he ended up having like a similar impact to what Justin Holiday does in Chicago, like, would that surprise you at all?
It wouldn't. No, I think that's conceptually the idea here. For reference point, when he got that offer from the Warriors, that was guaranteed, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So from an overarching standpoint,
I
think
2 years, 5.2, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I just from an overarching standpoint, I kind of think he got pretty bad advice here frankly, from the people who were advising him. Like, I don't agree with this move from him. I think this turned out maybe not poor, because I do think he's going to get a legit opportunity. But again, you're dealing with non-guaranteed money. If he doesn't come up big in the next 4 months and prove himself, like, it's going to be tougher for him. I still think a team's going to give him a shot. Like, he'll, you know, get like maybe a training camp deal if this doesn't work out, because he's a wing who has some ball skills. Like, he can conceptually dribble, pass, and shoot a little bit, even though I don't think it's going to be in a dynamic fashion. But I think he just got bad advice here.
So I'll kind of take it behind the veil a little bit. I asked around about this probably 3 months ago, something like that. 2 months ago, whenever his date passed. I can't really think about it off the top of my head, whenever the whole thing went down. What I got told was, like, it was more him than the advice that, like, he was getting. Because, like, at the end of the day, like, guys have to make decisions on their own lives, right? Like,
sure.
Agents can give the advice sometimes, and that, you know, advice will either go in one ear and out the other, or they'll accept it and say, like, hey, let's do this. I think that's worth remembering in cases like this, because I actually, like, I don't know what happened here. That's just, like, kind of, like, I'm not, like, I didn't report at the time that, like, you know, Patrick McCaw is not listening to Bill Duffy. I don't know if that is what happened here, but that's, like, kind of something that I got told, like, might have happened there, at least. So it's worth remembering that it might not always be a situation where you want to assume that the agent is at fault either.
Very fair. And let me rephrase then and say I don't agree with his decision or the advice that he got in the situation.
Yes. Just
because when you are, like I think he described it well, he wasn't really proven enough to decline a deal like that when you're talking about guaranteed money, $5.5 million or whatever it was. And now this is what the result is. Like, the NBA moves on very quickly from guys that aren't established. And I think that he should have just taken that guaranteed money. But at least he's getting a shot on a team that could really use him, and a team that is kind of searching for, you know, that surplus value contract. So maybe it works out for him. I hope it does.
Yeah, and look, at the end of the day here too, like, if you're Cleveland, you're doing Bill Duffy a solid here, which is good. Like,
yep.
Doing one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful agent in the business is a good thing, a favor, essentially. I think it helps. I think that that's the kind of stuff that helps. For him, it is interesting to look back. Like, let's assume that he gets this $3 million guaranteed and now gets, like, an opportunity to prove himself. I am not sure that, like, it worked out terribly for him. Like, yes, he doesn't get the extra $2 to $2.5 million. I forget exactly what the number was. But if you're willing to just, like, do that and bet on yourself, I at least, like, understand the thought process there. It could have ended up that, like, this didn't work out like this and this offer never came. But, like, it might not end up badly, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, I'm not convinced this is going to end up as a bad decision for him.
Oh, sure. I just think there was a lot of downside to declining that deal at the time. Yeah. Considering looking at the Warriors this year especially, like, they could have probably used him. They don't have a ton of depth. Like, Jacob Evans hasn't been ready for them. He's been playing in the G League. They haven't gotten contributions. And you're talking about a team like the Warriors where that's a huge stage. That's a huge platform. If you perform well there, I mean, of course, Kevon Looney didn't get paid as much as maybe we thought he would last offseason.
Yeah.
But that's a big. So that's big, not a wing. So not really the same comparison point there, but I do think there was probably more upside in taking the deal from the Warriors, just because, again, I think he would have played. If he played poorly, at least you have another guaranteed year. So I do agree, though. It could turn out well for him. At least he's going to get an opportunity.
Yeah. Let's move on. I like this deal for both McCaw and, like, right now, for assuming that other contract was a sunk cost. I like the deal for McCaw. I like the deal for the Cavs. For the Warriors, I think they had to make this move because it was going to cost them like $15 million to keep him. So I don't think that was something that they wanted to do. But let's move on. Let's talk about Dennis Smith. So Dennis Smith is playing actually pretty well over the last, like, what, week and a half, 2 weeks or so, I think. He also was noted in a Mark Stein newsletter saying, like, hey, they've, like, been willing to listen to offers on him, at least. So, I mean, like, what do we think of Dennis Smith? Because I think Dennis Smith is just a fascinating player to begin with. You were very high on Dennis Smith in the 2017 draft. I was higher than consensus, I think, on Dennis Smith, but probably not quite as high as you were.
Yeah.
Just, like, kind of generally, where are we at with how the Dennis Smith era is going here?
I think the hate has kind of gone a little bit too far. Like, people like to troll him now, especially because De'Aaron Fox has taken that leap. And it just takes a while for some of these point guards to really get access acclimated. I give Dennis a ton of credit this year. They started out the year as Dennis is the primary and Luka is the secondary. And obviously they've inverted those roles because Luka's just a better player, frankly. And I think that Dennis has actually adjusted to that pretty well. Like, he's defended a lot better this year. He's made significant improvement there. Like, everybody saw the play last night against Paul George at the end of the game where he contained and contested him. He's been playing that hard defensively. He's taking that energy of his past role being the initiator on offense, and now he's not. So he's exerting that defensively. So I think that he deserves some credit for that. If you read between the lines with this Dallas report, I think it makes a lot of sense for Dallas. They're not saying we need to trade Dennis, but they're saying we have a guy now. We have the guy. And at the end of the day, it's about optimizing Luka. If they feel like Dennis isn't that player, then they have to go out and get somebody who is. So I think they understand that if Dennis isn't the perfect fit, then they have to find somebody who is. And maybe they don't find that guy. Maybe they don't find a trade, but at least putting that on the market, that idea, will maybe elicit some offers and they can better optimize Luka. Because right now, Dennis is, in my opinion, more optimized as a secondary guy where he doesn't have to make all the decisions. He's kind of just playing the secondary creator. They're using him on Iverson cuts, getting to the rim. He's always been a pretty good catch-and-shoot guy. We've talked about that in the past. So, again, I feel like the role is really good for him right now, especially if he's going to defend. But at the end of the day, they're doing everything they can to optimize Luka. That has to be their thought process.
So, yeah, I agree with you on all of that. And I will note that, like, I actually think that this is a very good fit if they play Luka as the primary and play Dennis as like the secondary ball handler, because this is something that you and I talked about all the time. Like, anywhere that Luka has had success, he's had a secondary point guard next to him, like Goran Dragic with Slovenia. Anytime at Real Madrid, like Facundo Campazzo was their point guard last year, right? Like, you can play like dual ones, kind of, especially if that other one is going to take on tough defensive assignments like Dennis Smith is apparently embraced. Like, that, I think that is the part of it that most surprises me, is that like Dennis is taking on and like accepting and being challenged by playing really good defense. And that's not something he did often at NC State. It's something his athleticism would indicate he would be very good at, but it just hadn't happened. And the fact that he's doing it is very important. You mentioned the fact that you think that Dennis is a little bit better as a secondary, especially next to Luka. I would agree with that. His turnover rate has been awful this year. He just really has made like poor primary ball handler decisions. His turnovers per game have jumped from 2.8 to 3.3, while his usage rate has declined by 5.5%, 20.9 assist rate or turnover rate right now, I'm sorry, for Dennis Smith Jr. That is way too high. But here's the thing. So you look through his numbers, 66th percentile in catch and shoot shots. Again, this is something that he's been good at in the past. This is something that he has always, despite the shooting metrics overall being questionable, something he's been successful with. If you look at his off the dribble jumpers, he's actually in the 83rd percentile this year, which is surprising. 80th percentile overall as a shooter. While he is in the 20th percentile as an overall offensive player right now, according to Synergy, a lot of that has to do with A, the turnovers. That's the biggest part of it. But B, he is at a remarkably and unsustainably low percentile in transition for what his athleticism is. He is in the 6th percentile as a transition scorer right now, finishing 44% field goal percentage in transition right now. That is not going to hold just for what the athleticism is, for who he is. That's going to bounce, I think. Spot up guy, 89th percentile. That's really good. So like, he's doing all of the things that you would want a guy in Dennis Smith's shoes playing next to Luka Doncic to do. I kind of like it right now. Like, I think it actually really works.
I agree. And the point I made about optimization, I'm not saying Dennis is a bad fit. I actually think it's a very workable fit in these two roles. But maybe Dennis isn't the optimal fit. I think that maybe you look for somebody who's a little bit better of a defensive player. Even though Dennis is trying, he's still not very good off the ball. Just looking long term, I think a lot of people have taken the Jalen Brunson thing too far. Like, oh, this guy's a perfect fit next to Luka. Like, I don't think he's athletic enough to guard some of these guys. Like, he's not Dennis Smith. Like, there's no way that he can stay in front of Paul George and like force a pull up like that. So I think that narrative has gone a little bit too far. But maybe you want a little bit better decision making if you're trying to build a title team. And that's ultimately what we're doing here, because I think that the Mavericks have the guy. That's just my opinion. I think the Mavericks feel that way. So if they are thinking that way, they're saying, what is the best possible player next to Luka? I don't know if that's Dennis Smith. I do think the fit is workable, though, because of the steps he's made. If you watch Dennis at the beginning of the season, he was pretty aimless. There wasn't a lot of purpose in his game as the primary. He was just dribbling a lot. He just looked totally lost. And then when they flipped the roles and he started being the secondary guy where Carlisle could run an Iverson cut for him, and he's just having like two decisions to make. He's making quicker decisions, and he's like driving kick passing. I think he's improved a little bit there. So it's just about finding a comfort zone. And I think they have to use this time to really see, can Dennis function in this role, especially if he's going to defend. So I've been pretty taken aback in a positive fashion recently. I was like, okay, at the beginning of the season, I was like, Dennis hasn't made that strides. Like if you compare him to Fox, which everybody does, Fox makes much faster decisions. He just plays with such more purpose on the floor. Like that's the biggest difference between those guys.
Yeah.
But you put Dennis in more of a scoring role where it's a secondary. You can make some reads. I think that's the optimal fit for him.
Yeah, I agree with you. And with Dennis, we'll just kind of see where it goes now. I would not trade him if I was Dallas. I would just continue to see where this goes. You know, obviously you're going to get offers, and like I guess that like. What does a Dennis Smith offer even look like to you, right? Like, because Washington is a team that like theoretically should be looking for younger players who could potentially fit a longer term timeline. They have John Wall. They're not going to be looking to trade like Otto Porter for Dennis Smith, right? Like, you know, the Knicks, like maybe you could like do something with the Knicks if they don't like John Morant, or if you think that there are some guys on their roster that you want both short and long term, maybe that's interesting. Maybe like the Knicks would be willing to do something like Frank Ntilikina plus something else for Dennis Smith. Like if you just really are Dallas and you believe in Ntilikina's defensive ability next to Luka Doncic, like that the archetype there fits, if not the player necessarily. I would still rather have Dennis Smith than Frank. Chicago might make sense as well, is a place that has a young point guard. Maybe you could go and get like, see, but like, I don't know what you even go get from Chicago. Like, I don't think you trade Dennis Smith for like Justin Holiday and Bobby Portis, you know?
No, and all those teams are on this list I just created really quickly. There's been some people that have mentioned if the Pelicans go the Anthony Davis trade route, then maybe trying to move Dennis for like a Jrue Holiday, if they can do a larger deal in that respect. I get the conceptual idea. Like, I love Holiday. He's like one of my favorite players in the league, but he turns 29 in June. You know what I mean? Like, you have to align the core with Luka. Luka's 19. Like, you can't trade for a 29-year-old. Luka, technically, I think he can compete in the playoffs right now, but he's obviously not at his peak. So you have to kind of align your infrastructure with that. So that's a trade I wouldn't do. An interesting one is Orlando with Aaron Gordon, a larger constructive deal there. Because I think Aaron Gordon's actually, this is not my original idea. I've seen this on Twitter, so it's pretty popularized right now. But I think that fit would actually be really interesting with Aaron Gordon next to Luka, because he can kind of guard. You have two combo forward types, I guess, defensively. Like, they both have positional size. They can kind of switch and mismatch lineups. So that might be interesting, because, of course, Orlando needs a point guard.
Yeah, I think a lot depends on that, on what level you think Aaron Gordon is defensively. I do think he's better than what he gets credit for a lot of the time. Like, I think a lot of people consider him an overrated defender. He takes on really tough assignments for Orlando. Like, he is the guy guarding the opposing team's best, like, wing forward, like, every single night. And I like that. Like, I think that actually makes the most sense of anything I've heard yet.
Yeah, and it's not optimal, of course, because you still have Harrison Barnes, and in theory, you'd probably move on from Barnes in that case. Barnes just kind of irritates me as a player. He has no drive and kick vision at all. Just a very unwilling passer. I'm not sure if Gordon's the optimal fit, but that's just one of the trades that makes the most sense. People are going to bring up Phoenix. I don't want to pair Devin Booker and Dennis Smith in the backcourt defensively. That's kind of the idea behind Point Book, is you, like we talked about in the last podcast, you can go defensively and just have a bigger lineup. Doesn't make a lot of sense for me. With Chicago, like, Dennis would make some sense. I don't really believe in Chris Dunn as a point guard, but like, what do they really have that would interest Dallas outside of Wendell Carter, who I don't think that the Bulls would move for Dennis in that situation. So there's just not a lot. Like, Detroit has nothing really to offer long term. It's hard to find a fit, like, especially if you're Dallas. You're like, we're not just going to give Dennis Smith away. Like, the fit is good enough. He's shown enough to where I would value the sample size of the rest of the season, maybe next year, over trading him for 20 cents on the dollar.
It's actually, would you trade Dennis Smith and their first round pick, not the Atlanta first round pick, so like the Dallas first round pick, Or no. Dallas traded their first round pick to Atlanta. I'm sorry. So
yeah, top five productive
pick. Yeah, I flipped that in my brain. Yeah, like would you trade like a 2021 first and Dennis for Wendell Carter?
I would. Yeah, I think the two man game with Wendell and Luka would be awesome. That's kind of a long term fit that I could see really working out well. But again, I don't think Chicago does that.
I don't think so either. I wonder if I would do that. I don't think I would.
I'm it's lower so tough, on, man.
Yeah, I'm lower on Carter than most people are. I still don't think I would do that. If it was a 2019 pick that like had a chance to be in the top 10, I would say maybe, because then you'd actually get a chance to like actualize the value quicker as opposed to 2021 when you know Dallas is probably going to be good with Luka. Yeah, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah. And I would say just really quickly, I think Dallas would consider that just because, again, reports in the draft were that if they hadn't made that
trade, they loved Carter.
Probably would have taken. They loved Carter at five. So maybe they value him higher than most teams and they would part with Dennis plus a future first potentially. I don't know. I don't really know how they currently value Dennis. I don't know how the league does. It's kind of like when you draft a player and he's not immediately impactful. How values that player on the trade market? It depends on what you consider what Dennis's upside is. I'm still a little wary of him going to a team like Orlando and being the guy. So that's kind of where my reservations are. I think he's much better in the role he is now. But again, relative to Dallas, that's not their concern. They're not concerned about the avenue of Dennis to Luka. It's more about is Luka optimized with Dennis?
Yeah. Let's move on. So the next thing that I have on the schedule here is I was just like watching. Who was I watching? I think it might have actually been Chicago with like their like just massive malaise of big men. And then like I looked at their roster and I was like, you know, they have Wendell Carter, they have Lowry, they have Bobby Portis, obviously. Portis is out right now, but like his kind of situation made me think of things a little bit differently. So the idea here that I was wondering is, are we underrating getting like good young big men? Because you and I like hate drafting big men for the most part. I think that marginally we're lower on drafting big men when we have the opportunity to, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I think there's a couple caveats, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, like DeAndre Ayton to me is a caveat because I just fucking think DeAndre is incredible. you know, Jaren Jackson is a caveat up there. If you think Jaren Jackson, like Cole certainly does, and like I mostly do, like I think Jaren Jackson's a future all-star. If you think his guy is a future all-star, I think you just take them. But that's kind of not what I'm talking about, I guess. Like, I'm talking more about, like, when you get from, like, 16 onward down, is there value to just, like, getting a ready physically big man that you will have under long-term team control under an extremely cost-controlled number? Or do we just assume that big men can't really come into the NBA if they're drafted 16 to 30 and play real minutes? Like it's kind of like a half-cocked idea, as you guys can tell.
I have two kind of philosophies here. So I'm fine drafting bigs, but I think they have to have potential to be a difference maker in some capacity, whether that's defensively, maybe like a top 15 big in the league, for whatever, however you want to define that. I think, of course, Ayton, Jaren Jackson, Wendell Carter, for me, those guys satisfy that threshold. Mo Bamba, I mean, that's more high variance, but I think at his ceiling we can all make the argument that he is impactful. So those kind of guys are in one category. And then as you work your way down the draft, I think that they have to be at least guys who can impact the game immediately on their first contract. I think there's value in that. Like locking up a Jordan Bell, getting a Montrezl Harrell on your roster. Like those kinds of guys who can just be that third big and maybe an energy big. In this class, we see guys like Brandon Clark, Grant Williams. Like those kind of guys, I think, can make an immediate difference. And getting them under cost control for, you know, 3 or 4 years potentially, I think that does actually have value.
Like a Robert Williams this year, for instance, is a guy that like comes to mind for me.
Exactly right. And I think he has higher upside than that. He's more in like, to me, the Mitchell Robinson. I know you're a little lower on his starting and that's like his starting outcomes. I think that's possible. So that's more of an upside play that I think actually has real upside. In this next class, maybe Jackson Hayes satisfies that threshold. But for guys that are up for developmental bigs, this is where I kind of differ from the consensus. Developmental bigs like an Ike Anabogu, for example, I didn't think had starter upside. So I'm not going to invest. I'm not investing draft capital in him because he's probably a second contract guy developmentally. You're not going to get any value or return on that first contract, and I don't think the upside warrants it.
Yeah, like it almost has to be a big who is like ready to play immediately. Like Atlanta drafted Amari Spellman at the end of the first round here, right? Like I personally do not think that he's very good. Like I'm not an Amari Spellman guy. I had him outside of my top 50. But if you do think Amari Spellman is good and you believe in the jump shot and you think that he can like make a ready-made impact, I understand it. Like I guess that like I understand getting a guy who can be a floor spacing big under team control for 4 years, and then plus like maybe you get his restricted free agency rights later. Like that is the kind of guy that I'm interested in. Like this draft, like I was trying to like think of who the analog is this draft. Like you're higher on Jontay Porter, but like Jontay Porter is someone who reasonably might go in the second half of the first round, right?
Yes, and I absolutely think he has that kind of upside. Even if it's not a third big, like he can be like a Kelly Olynyk kind of big, and I think Olynyk is one of the best backup fives in the league.
Yeah, and like the other guy specifically that I was thinking of with this was Charles Bassey. Bassey is definitely physically ready to play in the NBA. He is averaging like 15, 10, and like 3 blocks right now for Western Kentucky. If you believe that guy is physically ready, is it worth taking him at 27, thinking you're getting a backup center who can be a rim protector, rim runner, and offensive rebounder?
I mean, it's definitely a fair argument if you buy those skills and his ability is translating. Like, I'm a little less sold on his pop. Like his vertical explosiveness isn't great. He's not a very dynamic leaper. So for me, I would favor a guy like Brandon Clark, where he's not as much of a straight five, but I think he's just going to contribute. Like he can handle the ball. You know, he's really bouncy. I think that the projection there is just a little bit cleaner, and we've seen those energy bigs that have dynamic athleticism translate pretty well. So for me, I would kind of tend to shy away from Bassey. I don't really see legitimate upside there, even though he does flash skills all around. Like we've seen him sometimes he dribbles. He has a little bit of shooting touch. I've seen some interesting passes from him. It just kind of depends on your evaluation, frankly. If you think that he has anything higher than the third big upside, I could see it maybe a little more justifiably. I'm not sure how much value his skill package really has, though, because he's not like a dynamic vertical spacer on a backup unit.
Right. So like, and then like you have to consider opportunity cost, right? Like,
yes.
Would you rather have him than Admiral Schofield, right? Like Admiral Schofield and Grant Williams, like two guys that are 6'5", long arms, play across the front court, kind of, I guess is the way to put it. Good defenders already, particularly in Schofield's case. Schofield's a shooter. Williams more of an attack closeouts floater, has a lot of interesting or like incredible feel stuff, really, not even interesting feel stuff. Like, would you pass on Bassey for those guys? I think there are teams that would. I think there are teams that would take Bassey over those guys. I still am at the point where I don't think I would.
And I'm with you. And this kind of builds into the conversation overall, but the draft is a lot about positional value and scarcity as well. I mean, people want to make arguments against that, but that's just the reality of the circumstance. How many teams need wings in the NBA? Every single one of them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you have to prioritize certain skill sets, especially when the bigs don't project to be either immediately impactful or have long-term like starter upside. Like, I love the Mitchell Robinson contract. I love the thought process in the second round. That's not going to happen every draft. You're not going to have Mitchell Robinson fall to 38, but for bigs with less upside, like Bassey to me has significantly less upside than Mitchell Robinson, I would prioritize wings, and I definitely would prioritize wings, and probably even like, it's really interesting with backup point guards. That's where this kind of gets interesting for me, is like, if you think that Trey Jones is an impactful backup point guard, let's say that's a reasonable projection, like, I would prioritize him.
I agree with you. Like I would prioritize Ty Jerome over him. Like, and I think Ty Jerome's like more of a two than a one. But like, you could probably have Ty Jerome run second units.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, this goes into what you can, the replaceability factor. So you can get a Kevon Looney last offseason. I think that he's a, you know, a valuable third big. Right. It's just really complex.
Huge. Yeah,
exactly. Right.
Especially whenever. So like, you look at the bigs that signed for the minimum. There are a ton of good bigs in Europe, like that you can find for minimum ish contracts, like Daniel Theis. For instance, is a really good example of someone coming over from Europe. Theis, like, didn't have a crazy amount of hype in Europe. Like, he was a really, really good player. If I remember correctly, he won the German League's Defensive Player of the Year. But, like, he wasn't a, you know, like, guaranteed, like, $1.5 million player in Europe, like some guys are. That's like kind of indicative of how easy it is to find bigs. Epe Udo is another example of a guy that like was really, really good in Europe, who flamed out in the NBA for a little while, came back after developing his game, and then like Epe Udo is like a totally comfortable and solid NBA big, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. That's the point here overall. I think that there is a little bit of second contract value if you take a guy who can help you immediately. Montrezl Harrell is the best example of this. Like, the market was very suppressed for his restricted free agency, and you can get a guy who, in my opinion, is like a low-end starter. Like, he's that good. But it has to be that kind of player, I think. Otherwise, you can go overseas. You can fill these guys in unrestricted free agency because there's just not a lot of demand right now. There's too many bigs unless you're a difference maker or you have, like, that long-term starter upside or you are a valuable third big in via immediately and long-term. I don't know what the demand is on the open market and how much we should be prioritizing that.
Yeah, like you can probably go get Johnny O'Brien, who is having a really good year over in the EuroLeague right now, averaging 11 points and like 7 rebounds or 6 rebounds a night or something. Shooting threes, kind of doing what you're hoping for from someone like that. And you can get him for the minimum probably this summer. So like that's another part of all of this. Like it's at the point where you really, the opportunity cost is so strong with a lot of these guys with positional value that I don't think I am at the stage where, even though like I started this conversation, I just thought it was more of an interesting topic of discussion more than anything to kind of put into context like positional values. Like I said, it was a half-cocked idea that I think turned out to be a reasonable discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just one more point from me at the top half of the draft, and like we're talking about the elite prospects, I'm not saying to devalue bigs to the point where if there are valuable bigs, like actual good bigs, like in the 2018 draft, I'm not saying to knock those guys down because they're bigs. You still have to take those guys. If that's the draft and the draft is the value is in the bigs, I think you still invest in those guys if they can be difference makers. It's just when we're talking about, you know, lower in the draft, when these guys aren't really impactful guys, that's when I think you have to prioritize position a little bit more, just because obviously like you prioritize Luka Doncic if the wing is really good or the primary ball handler is really good at the top. But that the conversation gets much more interesting to me as you work your way down the draft.
Yeah, like DeAndre Ayton is fucking incredible. He's averaging like 17, 11, and 2 right now on 60% shooting from the field. Take that guy. You know what I mean? Like, at the very least, take him. If you like, you're lower on him. You have Luka Doncic and Jaren Jackson ahead of him right now. You would still probably take him number 3 in this draft, right? Like something like that.
Let's not go into that. But yeah, I mean, like it's very, very arguable for sure. I'm not taking like a wing I had at 13 just because he's a wing over DeAndre Ayton. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Right. So like DeAndre Ayton goes number 1 in the draft, like you're not taking Mikal Bridges over him, like to actually talk about a teammate, right? Like Mikal Bridges goes 10th. He's having a really good rookie year. You're probably like, I'm not taking Shai Gilgeous-Alexander over him still. You're probably not taking Shai, right?
Over Ayton?
Yeah.
No. That goes to your point. Exactly. Like I'm not taking these guys who might in theory, I think you can make an argument that it's easier for them to be on a winning team just because of the demands defensively of a center. But still, I think you have to go with the upside and the better prospect. So that kind of puts it in context.
Yeah, for sure. All right. The last thing we're going to talk about before I let the listeners out of here at a svelte hour and a half. year in like end of year. 2019 NBA draft stuff. I don't really think that maybe at the beginning of next year we'll do our thing where like we look back on the, we've kind of did that last week though, where we look back on the 2018 draft and like kind of reassessed some things. You know, maybe we should do that on like an earlier draft at some point, but just to like kind of look through our process and like get better at this. But let's talk about the 2019 draft. Guys who have like really helped themselves thus far in the new year. Really, the draft season has been going for like 6 months, despite the fact these guys have only played like 2 months of real games, just given camps, given all of the different things that they do in front of NBA scouts. You know, maybe you could even say like this NBA draft season has been going for 2 years. If you want to go back to like Adidas Nations when Zion Williamson was there as a sophomore in high school, right?
Sure.
I don't know if we need to necessarily go that far, but who are some of the guys that you think helped their NBA draft stock for the 2019 draft in 2018?
I think I have to start with Jarrett Culver. For me personally, like I was relatively high on him just because last year he was incredible as far as, like, as a freshman, his IQ always popped for me. Team defense, he just really knows what to do on the floor, good passer. But for me, the overarching difference has been his tweaks in his shooting mechanics, and that's something I noticed right away this season. He's made improvements there. If you remember last year, his shot line was much further to the left. He kind of brought it up, and he would flick it across his face, very awkward. Even sometimes he would finish, his wrist would snap away from the basket. So it was kind of like he was, I don't want to say backhanding because that's not the right description, but it was very much, I didn't buy the shot. It was like a worse version of Lonzo Ball's shot. It didn't snap the same way either. Like, Lonzo at least has alignment at the end of his release. And this year, he's made improvements there. His pull-up actually looks decent. He had that pull-up over RJ Barrett. He had one kind of one-footed fadeaway Dirk shot that you sent me via text. So I think that he's made mechanical improvements there, and that's really what I was looking for from him, because he brings pretty much everything to the table. Our Ben Rubin on our site has a theory that he has grown and he's like 6'7", or he could get to 6'8". I'm not really sure. The combine is going to be really fascinating for him, but this is a guy who can really dribble, pass, and shoot and be a secondary ball handler, depending on the shooting variance. I don't think he's like a dynamic off-movement shooter, but he's shown enough shooting this year via shot diversity that I'm very intrigued.
Oh, straight up, I think he's grown. Like, I think he has gotten taller. Texas Tech has actually bumped up his height to 6'6". Like, I think he is actually just, like, bigger than he was last year. I don't know if I would say 6'7". I think that might be stretching it. But I think that, like, he is a legit 6'6", looking at him now. You mentioned the pull-up ability. I actually think he's, like, straight up a really good pull-up shooter now. The moves that he makes are, like, legit NBA moves, where he will go, like, right-to-left crossover, step back, direct into a fluid jumper. Or, like, pump fake, sidestep, pull-up jumper. They're just really translatable moves, and the numbers are backing us up on that, right? Like, he's 97th percentile in guarded catch and shoots, and he's making 1 point per possession on each of his jump shots off the dribble this year, which is about in the top one-fifth of all NBA players, or all college basketball players, I'm sorry. He is just very good, and plus he's a very good defender. He's 6'6", he's a wing. I have him at like number 8 or number 9 on my board. I think that might be low. Like, I think that might be a little bit low. He's very good. He's really, really good. To me, he's one of the 5 best players in college basketball this season.
I agree with you, and I think that what you're getting with him is a little bit more certainty than a lot of these other prospects. Like, you can make an argument Kevin Porter Jr. is more talented. He's gotten way more live dribble game as far as his explosiveness in and out of his moves. Culver doesn't really win that way. He's more deceptive with his handle. Kind of reminds me of Shea a little bit in that capacity, only just because he wins with awkward change of pace. He does have a good handle. He's been very good in pick and roll this year. But I think the allure for him is, and this is a degree thing with the height. I agree with you. He's definitely gotten taller. The question is, how much taller is he going to get? Is he 6'7"? Can he get to like 6'8"? If he gets to that level and you have a guy that tall who can handle the ball and he really fills out his frame, I think you have a really intriguing prospect. So you're getting some upside with him, just because how many 6'6", 6'7" guys do you find who can dribble, pass, and shoot? You just don't find that many guys in the draft. But he's also bringing a level to certainty to this class, which really lacks it, honestly. There's so much variance at the top of this class as you get down to the latter half of the top 10. I think I would bank on this guy over most of these guys.
Oh, I'll be straight up honest. Like, if you think he is going to get to 6'8", which, again, I have no evidence of him, like, growing to 6'8", but if you think he's going to get to 6'8", you should take him third in this draft. Like, straight up. Like, you really should, because he is just an awesome knockdown shooter at this stage. He actually knows how to defend on and off ball. He's like the perfect wing, and if you think he's 6'8", then you're probably going to be able to guard fours with him at this stage. Like, it's like, he's a better prospect than DeAndre Hunter if you think he is getting to be as big as DeAndre Hunter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of the argument for him in the top three, because you see that shift a lot with a lot of draft guys. Is like, he could be valued that highly if you value the upside. And again, my last point on him is he has legitimate feel. Like, this guy knows how to fucking play basketball. And in this draft, that goes a long way. If we're looking at guys, because this is why I thought last year was so special, is because a lot of those guys really knew how to play, and they combined that with high skill level and like high intellect. They met those thresholds. This class, not so much for most part, but this guy definitely does. Like, Culver's the real deal. If, you know, the shooting is real, which I expect this year, I'm more confident, and that's why I have him. I think right now I'd probably take him, you know, upper half of the lottery. I just think that he's that good.
Yeah, I think that I would have him at like 7 right now, something like that.
Fair.
I'm writing about him for this week. I've talked to him. He's an awesome kid. Very, very nice kid. You should go look for that on The Athletic. The guy also, that
really
I
quickly.
Will... Go ahead.
Sorry, I gotta say really quickly on that Duke game, if people want to go watch that, they had a really nice segment on him as far as like his film watching. I think the sideline reporter, I don't remember her name, but she reported all this, and like he's a really avid film watcher. They talked about him for about a minute, and it was about everything you'd ever want to hear for people on the outside like me who don't get, you know, interviews and stuff like that. It was everything you want to hear about a prospect.
Yeah, I talked to him a good amount about that as well. That'll come in the story. He's very much a very much an avid film watcher, very much like an awesome, just like an awesome kid from Lubbock. Like that's where I'll leave it. You should go read The Athletic later this week. The guy I want to mention is Ja Morant. Ja Morant was a guy who I think nobody knew who he was outside of like extremely avid draft writers. Like when January started of 2018, he was, if you look through his like freshman year numbers, only him and Lonzo Ball have like done what they did as freshmen, averaging like 13, 6.5, and 6.5, statistically. And Lonzo did it on like wild, crazy pace, and Ja Morant did it on, I think, like a national average pace. I talked to him at the NCAA tournament. I knew how good he was then. I did not expect him to make the leap that he has in terms of his ability to take on like a full lead primary ball handling role where he is the guy who is the primary scorer, primary distributor, and like everything for Murray State.
It's hard to argue with any of that. I mean, his usage this year has been unreal. I have not watched the Auburn game yet, so that's a pretty big input for me. I still got to get that probably in the next couple games or next couple days, I should say. So I don't want to chime in too extreme a fashion. There's a lot to like here. This is more of a philosophical debate as far as how good does a guy have to be offensively if you're that size. And I don't think that his athleticism is to the level that a lot of people do. I think he loses a lot of that in the half court. Like, you see the explosive 2-foot leaping ability in space. Like, he looks like really dynamic. Mm-hmm. And then you see him in the half court off one, more in traffic, and he loses a lot of that. And his strength is a really big negative, in my opinion.
So I agree with you on he loses explosiveness jumping off of 1 foot. But what I will say is he is very good at contorting his body. He has really good body control, and he gets really good hang time. He changes angles on rim protectors really well, and he goes straight into contact every time. Like, that dude is totally unafraid of however big you are. He's going to go into your body and try and change the angle and finish under you, over you, wherever he thinks he can finish. So if you think you can get him stronger, then I think there's a real case to take him at like number 4 or number 5 in the draft. But I'm with you in that I am like concerned about the fact that his frame is a real concern. His overall explosiveness in the half court at the basket is a small concern as well.
And I think also the shooting is, I don't want to say
and the turnovers. Yeah, like there are concerns.
I'm not really too, like, the overarching turnover number isn't going to like draw me off of him just because of his usage. Like you said, his role is like he has to do everything. So some of the decisions he makes are the concern for me. That's built into the turnovers, of course. And I'm not sure how quick he processes the game. He does have very good vision, very good craft. We talked about Trey Young last year with those left-handed push passes. Ja has that in his game already, so that's a positive.
They aren't even just like push passes. He will like cross court left-handed pass, like a pass that like very few NBA guards make. One-handed cross court, like pick and roll whip pass with his offhand. It's crazy.
Yeah, and that's something you need at that size, honestly, because you're not going to be able to pass over the top of guys like Luka does. You got to have, in those tighter confines, if you have that pass going to your left, I think that's big. So there are some really big positives in this game. His handle's good. He's deceptive. You know, I think you've talked about this with Chris Doan in the past. We don't have to rehash all of this. I just think that the pull-up gravity is going to be something really interesting. His release isn't dynamically quick. It's okay, but it takes a little bit too long to load. You've seen him get a shot blocked a couple times on step-backs. He can create the separation as far as his step-back ability, but the release is a little too slow for how low it is. Like, it's not as quick as Darius Garland or Trey Young. That's going to matter, I think, a little bit. My primary concern with him, outside of like the decision-making, some of the finishing stuff with the strength, is that I don't think guys are going to guard him like a shooter, because I don't know if his pull-up is that dynamic. Yeah. He can make it, but it's more in the sense of he can make it when guys duck under screens and he has a bunch of space. And I don't think he has the reputation. Like, that's something Trey has. People still guard him like a star shooter. And I don't think that Ja's going to get that treatment, and that might negate some of his impact, ability to get in the lane and, like, kick out and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like... how bad of a shooter is Trae Young right now? It's unbelievable.
He's really better, just incredible. Last eight games, he's like 38-39% from three, and Trae's a much better shooter than Moran is. Like, right. Straight up.
And like, Trae is
much
like
better touch.
Trae is a good shooter. Like, he's streaky, but like, he's a good shooter. Like, I'm not worried about Trae eventually getting to like a good level of shooting. It's just like crazy that this is where we're at right now with him.
Oh, it's been crazy all year. But yeah, that's my primary concern with Moran. It's like, I'm not sure how good his touch is. I'm not saying it's bad. It seems okay. He's got the good free throw percentage mark, which people point out, but I've gone back and looked over his floaters. We've talked about this on the past podcast, yeah, as far as touch goes. And I think he's 4 of 24 on floaters over this two seasons. So just one number, it's very small sample size, but I think some of the shots he puts up show maybe not advanced touch. It's still respectable. So the shooting is going to be it for him, because if people don't have to guard him that way, he's going to take things off the table defensively. He's not a good defensive player. And I don't know how he's going to be. Like, he has the length in theory, but the strength is, to me, really, really important with these smaller guards. And he doesn't have that.
Yeah, he's good at getting to passing lanes. Like, I think he actually does have like good instincts for forcing turnovers and forcing live ball situations in transition, but that's not enough, really. Like, you just need to be better overall as a team defender, especially if you're going to be that small. Like, Ty Jerome doesn't have the quickness that Ja Morant does, but where Ty Jerome gets by is that he's an incredibly smart team defender who also is incredibly disruptive with his hands when he's on the ball. Like, it's not like he's just going out and forcing turnovers by sprinting out into passing lanes and trying to, you know, potentially give your defense a bad on or bad disadvantage situation. He is good at like just getting mirroring your hands as an offensive player and getting a steal that way, or just making your life more difficult.
Sure, and he's bigger than Moran. I think that really matters, the size and the strength. That's impactful. But overall, I think no matter what you think about Morant, he's clearly risen this year. He's being considered, yes, now in the top five. And that's kind of the takeaway here, is like, some of these guys, maybe we deviate a little bit from consensus on. I can't speak for you, but I'm not as sold on him as a top five guy as a lot of people are right now.
Yeah, I have him at like number six on my board. And okay, I think that like, if you compare him to last draft, he goes probably late lottery, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I think I like him more than I like Sexton, but the same overarching issues, like much different players, of course, but the same,
yeah.
It's a philosophy question. Just how good you have to be offensively to really invest in long term at that position when you're taking things off the table defensively.
Like, I still would have taken Shea over him, I think.
Oh, yes.
And I probably would have, like, I had Miles Bridges at eight. I think I probably would have taken Miles over him, too.
100%.
So, like, that's more the player that we're talking about, I think, as opposed to, like, a guy that is, like, an incredible, like, franchise-changing point guard right now, in my opinion, at least. We'll see how the rest of the year goes. I'll mention Ty Jerome. Like, I think Ty Jerome's really helped himself this year. The fact that he is playing defense at such a high level, the fact that he's shooting 43%, the fact that he's so good coming around screens and getting separation, like, that stuff all matters.
Easy to fill role for him at the pro level as far as utilizing his off-screen gravity as a shooter. Very smart player, can make a read, not dynamic as far as getting to the rim, lacks explosiveness. That's his main. If he was more explosive, it would be a much easier projection for him. But very high IQ player who really just gets it and can shoot the ball off movement. If he's going to thrive, I think it's probably going to be in like a bigger point guard role next to another like initiator. So the Sixers took him and he plays next to Ben Simmons. I think that's kind of the fit you're looking for with this kind of player.
Yeah, the same with like Nikhil Alexander Walker.
Yes,
you know, the same player type. I think Nikhil probably has a little bit higher of a ceiling because I think he's much better in pick and roll situations, getting all the way to the basket. Maybe a slightly worse shooter despite what the percentages say right now. But like same kind of player type. I think Nikhil's probably more of like a potential starter, whereas Ty is like more of a backup.
I think that's definitely fair. Nikhil has risen a little bit too high in my opinion, just because you see the advancement in his game this year as far as on the ball.
Well, where's too high for you first? Let me start there.
I think some people have him like lottery level, and okay, that's like a little bit that's a little bit high for me, just because I look at his defense and I know he tries and he's pretty good in college, but his frame, it just leaves a lot to be desired for me. 6'5" guard, it's just not meeting that threshold of safety that I like, and I don't see the upside as being something like outstanding. Like, he's good craft, you know, he's a smart player, his shot, it seems pretty functional, but overall I just don't know how well those kinds of players translate to the NBA.
Yeah, so I've got him at like 20 right now. I tend to believe in guys that are excellent shooters, which he clearly is, I think, and combine that with terrific ball handling ability at like size. You know what I mean? Like, he's 6'5 with a 6'10 wingspan and is a 40% three-point shooter and can play pick and roll. Like, at the very least, I feel like that is a backup secondary ball handler.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. I get the argument for him. I just don't know if he really plays to that size consistently. Like, I get the measurements, but I don't know against NBA athletes who are bigger. I don't know how functional his size really is. Like, he's a bigger point guard, but I don't know if he plays like it. Like, to me, D'Anthony Melton's shorter, but he plays to his size much more than... And it's really hard to be a good defensive player in the NBA if you are that, you know, if you have that frame. So that's my knock on him, is like, I get the offensive appeal. He is smart. I'm not sure about like the deceptive handling. Like, he's not super explosive in and out of his moves. You're looking at him as more of a shooter who can handle a secondary pick and roll. So that has appeal. Is he going to finish at the rim? He's got good craft. He's got a great left hand. But is it going to really translate to the level that you'd think? I just think some of the people are getting a little bit too high on him. But like, latter half of the first round, I get the argument more. It's just not like my favorite kind of player to invest in.
Yeah, no, and I get that. I will say, I think that he looks a lot better this year in terms of his frame. Last year I thought he was way too skinny. This year he's at like 205 pounds. He looks like more sturdy. Maybe sturdy is the way to put it. He doesn't look like he's gonna get blown over by a strong wind, so that's nice. So like, overall, I actually think that I'm not in lottery level like some people are, you think, like, apparently. But I guess like we're kind of similar on this, right? Like, it seems like.
Yeah, and especially
maybe you're
again,
a little lower.
If you're viewing him in that same role of like kind of the de facto point guard, but not really, like you're playing the one defensively, maybe I get that a lot more. If you're going to play him on the wing, I don't know if you're going to get that return on investment. Like, the thing that I like about him is he brings some playmaking and you can incur that size at the one. But if you play him on the wing, I don't know how valuable he really is.
KZ Apala is the next guy for me. I think he is like definitely a top 20 guy in this class. He can actually shoot now, which is a significant change from what like I talked to Pac-12 coaches last year about him. Like, part of the reason that Stanford struggled last year when he started playing was they would genuinely just sag off of him. They'd be like, fuck this guy can't shoot. Like, we're just gonna pack the paint, we're gonna force Dejon to beat us from the outside, we're gonna force KZ Apala to beat us from the outside, and we're gonna do it that way, right? With Apala now, like, he's shooting 49% on 3 3-point attempts a game, and the shot actually looks good, like, mechanically. It's totally changed. If he is a 6'8" playmaking four who can shoot at like a 37% clip from the NBA line, he's a top 20 pick, just straight up.
Not a direct comparison, but I'm just curious in your thoughts on this. How do you view him compared to Chandler Hutchinson?
I think he's better than Chandler, actually.
Okay.
Because I buy the jump shot more.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of intrigued with some of the playmaking flashes he's shown. Like, he's pretty comfortable with the ball. I'm not saying he's like even a secondary guy, but he blew by Nasir Little. I haven't watched him in a while. I watched him a little bit in the beginning of the season, but he had some appeal there. He's a pretty good athlete. I agree with you. The shot off the catch actually looks pretty fluid, but not someone who has a ton of shot diversity. You look at his pull-ups, 1 of 9. You look at his off-screen. He doesn't have a lot of usage there. To me, if I was going to buy him high, I would want him to be like an off-movement shooter. I think that would be the intrigue there, unless he's like this defensive stopper. It kind of just goes into what your idea of his defense is.
Yeah, and it's a really good question what his defense is, because on the plus side for what his like future projection is, Stanford plays him nonsensically at the three a decent amount. Like, he is 6'8" with a 7'2" wingspan, and he is playing the three occasionally. Like, he splits time between the three and the four, but like, it is a thing that he plays the three, and that is insane. Like, the off movement stuff where you see him occasionally off of movement is you'll see him like pick and pop sometimes, which is interesting, but it's not quite the same in terms of off movement is what you and I talk about when we talk about shooting off of movement. So far this season, he's taken 21 catch and shoot shots. He's in the 96th percentile. pretty good finisher at the basket, not like the world's most explosive leaper. But again, when you're 6'8 with a 7'2 wingspan and you can like actually attack closeouts and do the things that he is capable of, you can just kind of make that work at the NBA level with that kind of size and length. So I don't know. I think it's very interesting. I think he is like, if you believe in the defense and you believe that he is a good perimeter defender on fours, I think he is like straight up a top 20 pick.
Yeah, I get the rationale for sure. Can he protect the rim from the weak side? That's something you look for fours. Yeah. Is he going to be physical enough on a lot of these guys? He just seems kind of like a tweener type between the three and the four, which in the modern game isn't a bad thing necessarily. Just not quite as sold. I like his ball handling ability. Like I said, decision making is going to be something I'll look for. You know, negative assist turnover ratio that I'm looking at. So not the best there for like kind of a wing four playmaker type. But I did like the handle. He did flash some passing, but I don't know about the decision making yet. I haven't seen him in probably a month or so. So definitely someone I'm going to go back over. I get the intrigue. I just don't know if he's really the player that a lot of people describe him as.
Yeah, and like the other big like question is how does the body fill out? Most people that I've spoken with like believe the body is really going to fill out. Like they think he is going to be like 6'8", 240 pounds, 7'2 wingspan, like just massive like human being who is a full stop four that can shoot threes at the next level. I don't know what to think of that yet. I think that's a lofty projection, but if you think that that's where, if you think that's where he gets to and you think he can retain all of the ball handling stuff, he's a lottery pick. But like, I don't know yet what to do with that.
Yeah, that's the guy we're talking about. Then I'm very, very interested in him. If he can really fill out and he can play the four and you bring that kind of handle and, you know, he can switch a little bit on defense. I'm a fan of his perimeter defense. We'll see about the interior as far as rotations and stuff over the rest of the season. But if that's the guy that we're describing, I don't even think he has to shoot off movement in that case. If he's like a straight four and that big and he can handle these more physical interior guys and then give you that plus perimeter skill on the other side, then we have a real player.
Yeah, so we'll see how he develops the rest of the year. I'm going to see him live this week in the first non-Steve Alford UCLA game, so that'll be fun.
There you go.
Who are a couple other guys that you want to mention? I've kind of jumped all over the board in terms of guys that I like.
Yeah, Ignas Brazdeikis is someone I think we have to bring up just because I've been pretty impressed with him. Someone I saw at the Hoop Summit, and I was like, okay, he's kind of interesting. The general takeaway was, I wish this guy was Dario Saric's size, just because you can see it more at the four. I'm not saying I'm totally bought in yet, but I do like some of the things I've seen. Very, very polished as far as his off-ball scoring game. Very good cutting instincts. I mean, I know some of that's Michigan's offense, but he really knows how to move off the ball and find spots. Very polished as far as footwork. You see him catch on the hop pretty much every time for a shot. Very aggressive in cash and go situations. I've been impressed there. He's a better horizontal athlete than I thought he was. We knew about the power game. You know, when he can load up off two, he's relatively explosive. He's got that power. But I've been impressed with some of the lateral quickness, both defensively and initially on these drives. I think he separates a little bit better than I gave him credit for.
Yeah, I think I actually agree with you on that. I think that he is a better athlete than what I thought he was. He is a better defender than what I thought he was. Like, he's actually okay as a freshman, as a team defender right now. Like, he's in the most sheltered situation that you could possibly ask for, right? Like, John Teske is a really good defender. Charles Matthews is, like, one of the five best wing defenders in college basketball. Xavier Simpson, I think, is the best perimeter defender or lead guard defender in college basketball. You know, the situation he's in schematically with Luke Jokljic teaching and doing everything that Jok does up there, like, it is the best possible situation for him defensively. But I think it's worth mentioning that he performs their scheme to a level that I was not expecting him to be able to perform at this season. In terms of his shooting, that is all translated, 43% from three, 50% overall, 51% overall. I'm sorry that I cut him off one there. 77% from the line. He's been very good. I think he is genuinely a top 50 prospect in this class.
Yeah, and I might honestly have him higher at the end of the year. I just think that when you get a guy that size, and he's already filled out, you don't have to worry about the frame. Like, he's strong. He's kind of a bull. And if he can really shoot, I'm looking most at the shooting off movement. We haven't really seen that. He's only had four attempts, 0 for 2. We haven't seen if he can really come off a screen and set quickly and shoot. That's going to be the most interesting skill to monitor for him moving forward, because I kind of buy. I don't know if he's like ultra switchable as far as like the quickest feet, but he's impressed me more on that end where I would kind of just bank on his frame and the fact that he can really score in advantage opportunities. You don't have to run plays for him necessarily unless it's like off screens. He's more of a guy who's just going to siphon off baskets over the course of a game that you won't really notice, but I think he can be pretty efficient doing that if he can shoot the ball off movement and shoot at a high level.
You know what else he's a really good offensive rebounder for, like, a guy who crashes off the wing like that too. He gets like a lot of like little random like tip in opportunities, but he's also smart about when he takes the opportunities. You know what I mean? Like, he takes his chances well, going toward the basket and crashing for offensive rebounds, and doesn't overshoot that, I guess, is my point.
Exactly. And that just goes into the overarching kind of off ball instincts role. He just looks, again, really polished compared to a lot of these freshmen. I was kind of taking it back. I know the Michigan situation is a very cushy situation, but even on the tape, he just kind of pops as far as just his ability to get baskets and his awareness of spatial awareness off the ball. I think he just really gets it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You like the Tennessee guys like I do? Should we talk about the Tennessee guys?
Sure. I mean, I mentioned Grant Williams a little bit. He's one of the smartest players I've seen all year. And those kind of guys, like last year, is kind of Kenrich Williams. They're not similar players, like that similar, but just those kind of guys typically pop when you watch the tape. Like, they're just, you know, they make really good decisions, and you can just see the consistency. You don't see the wheels turning. And I think Williams has added a little bit to his shot. I don't mind his mechanics, honestly. I'm not sure if they translate to NBA 3 necessarily, but they're pretty clean. And he's had some pull-up jumpers that are really interesting. If you play him at the 4, maybe he can make plays there. He's not the most dynamic athlete, but just I think he can go a long way with a guy who I believe in the foundational mechanics. He's super young for his age group or his year, which is crazy. I had no idea he was that young. So yeah. I think there might be a
he's
little bit more
upside. He's still
20,
right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think there's real upside as a shooter still. We talk about like the floater, like runner touch stuff, or at least we've started to do that over the course of like the last few weeks. He's a guy, I don't think that like Synergy captures all of his floaters. I think that they qualify some of them as like jumpers, because they're like these weird kind of push shots. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like, he definitely has that to his game. Like, it statistically, like, I don't know that I need to really even like look at the numbers on it. He just, like, we've seen it. We know that he naturally has that like kind of push floater shot.
Yeah, and he's actually 3 for 3 this year, so not a big sample, but you can, like you said, you can kind of see that on tape. He's got really good touch. A little bit of upside as like a difficult shot maker type at the 4. I think he's mostly going to be a 4. He's going to be switchable enough to where maybe the strength, he can switch onto some small ball 5s, maybe some 3s. But yeah, some untapped upside there for a prospect that a lot of people probably wouldn't attribute that to.
Yeah, and like, I have him like borderline like end of the first round right now. Do you have him in the first round?
I do.
Yeah, like I think that, like, we're not going crazy here. Like, we're not like full on calling him a lottery pick, but like, I really like him. And if you look at the statistical stuff in terms of his profile, like, every player who has done what he's done production wise has gone in the first round.
Yep. And I think that's a point that Ben Rubin made again. One other stat, 2.1 assist to turnover ratio in the half court, which I think is really impressive. Like, that's indicative of what, you don't have to just put all your eggs in the assist to turnover basket, but you can see that manifest on the floor pretty clearly.
Yeah, I agree with you. And then Admiral Schofield, I just think like NBA stars are gonna love playing with that dude. That dude will I had one scout tell me like he thinks that guy will like fight like for his teammates. Like, he will like genuinely get into like a scrap if he thinks his teammates are being disrespected. Like, that stuff is like things that NBA players and NBA stars particularly love. He's a 39% to 41% 3-point shooter in college, I think, although like he takes all of his threes right behind the line for the most part. This year he's extended out a little bit, I'll say that, but like the last couple years it's been like right at the line, and that's a little bit scary. But he's also an awesome defender, really, really tough defensively, switchable across 3 positions, 2 through 4. He can slide like a couple slides with guards. He's physical enough to body up with centers in mismatch situations because he's like 6'5", 240 pounds. His brother was O'Brien Schofield, who was a linebacker at Wisconsin, played in the NFL for a few years for your Seattle Seahawks, if I remember correctly.
Remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So has that kind of mentality. I love him as a role player. I have him as a first round pick right now. Just kind of a perfect fit for the way the NBA is going.
I'm not quite there yet with him, but there is some intrigue. He flashes that off movement shooting. He has that kind of balance. He hasn't been super efficient at it this year, but I like seeing that in this game. I'm not as sold on the perimeter skill yet. The decision making hasn't really been there consistently. It's not bad. It just doesn't really, it's not like Grant Williams level for me. So he hasn't jumped off the screen in the same way, but I'm going to watch him a lot more as the season progresses. I definitely get the intrigue though. I mean, you're talking about someone 6'6" with a 240-pound frame who can shoot the ball, and it, like, that's going to have some value. Like, I think he definitely gets drafted, right?
Oh, no question. Like, I have him at like 24 right now. That's higher than NBA teams that I've talked to, for sure. Most NBA teams have him as a second round guy. I straight up think that, like, that is a guy I want to go to, like, battle with. If I take him at 24 and I miss on it, that's fine. He's going to work his ass off. He's going to be an incredible teammate. Like, people who, like, have been around that program, they talk incessantly about how hard he has worked to get to where he is skill wise. Just like, he's just the guy that I want to bet on, I guess. Like, I'm comfortable just betting on Admiral Schofield figuring it out and doing what he wants to do.
Makes a lot of sense. And from that description, I'd be really surprised then if he got to the latter half of the second round. Like, I think a team will probably take the gamble there early second round. One more guy to bring up for me quickly for Tennessee is Eve Pons. I'm not really sure what the hell Eve Pons is, but he's one of the best athletes in college basketball. When he's engaged defensively, like, he's got legit difference making on ball athleticism.
The preeminent Eve Pons podcast.
This is like Zaire Smith 2.0 here with Eve Pons, but I do think there's still, I'm not sure, like, he doesn't really think the game quickly. I don't know about the skill level, of course, but for a developmental guy, I'm kind of intrigued with him as like a G League guy.
I think he is at least a year away.
Sure.
Like, let him stay in college for a year. Let's see where we are in the 2020 draft.
I think that's the reasonable response, but I've never been one to be reasonable, so I like him. He's just kind of one of those bigger kind of combo forward types that just have supreme athleticism. I just don't think those guys come around that often, so I would invest a little bit here. I'm not saying, I mean, if he came out this year, do you think he'd even get drafted?
I would say there is a chance, because I think you might be able to convince him to, like, be a stash in Europe, and there are, like, just not a lot of those this year, like, to where it might be valuable for an NBA team to say, hey, we'll take you. We're not going to use a two-way on you immediately. We're going to set you up in Europe in a good developmental situation, and we'll check back in with you in 2 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. People should definitely watch Tennessee. Like, they're a really, really fun team to watch. If you haven't seen that Gonzaga game, that might be my favorite college basketball game of the season so far. It's up there.
It is definitely my favorite college basketball game of the season. The next guy really might be the last guy. I'll throw it to you one more time after this guy, but Jackson Hayes is fascinating to me. I don't know what the fuck Jackson Hayes is. Like, he's definitely a center, obviously, and like a rim runner, and he like blocks a shit ton of shots, but like, he's, part of me likes him like slightly more than Daniel Gafford, and then like part of me likes him like he's just a lot less productive, and like he's a lot lower usage than Daniel Gafford too. So like, and like, I definitely don't think he's the shooter Gafford was last year. So like, I don't know. What is Jackson Hayes?
This was the last guy on my list as well. So, and this kind of ties into the conversation we had earlier about bigs and how you go about evaluating them contextually. I don't know either. I mean, what I like about him is that he's enormous. Like, he actually has legit center size in this class. Like, he might get to the point where he's as big as a Steven Adams type. I'm not saying he's going to be that kind of player, obviously, because Adams has supreme toughness, and Hayes plays a little bit smaller than I'd like to see from that guy. But you look at his frame, like, this guy could probably carry 260 pounds, and he has a 7'5" wingspan, something like that, and nobody else has that in this class. So if you're looking for a developmental big long-term, I don't... Like, his instincts aren't bad to me. Like, he's a very late bloomer, was a football player. He doesn't do things on the floor that really irritate me, but he doesn't really do a lot on the floor for Texas. Like, every time on offense, he just basically sets a screen and dives to the rim. Sometimes he doesn't even look for the ball until he's already around the basket. Like, you can see his role's very rehearsed. But defensively, he makes the rotations. He's not, like, a super bouncy athlete. He's good, but his movement skills are elite for his size. Like, he really runs the floor well. I think Jackson Hoy, who writes for the Stepping as well, just posted this clip of him in transition handling the ball, and then he had a step around move and a layup and stuff. Like, his movement skills are really good for his size. It's just a question of how much time do you really want to develop? Like, where do you think he is developmentally compared to like a Jarrett Allen type?
Definitely not as far along as Jarrett Allen was.
I agree.
Like, Jared Allen had much better defensive instincts in terms of rotating weak side. Jared Allen, I don't know if he had, I think Jared Allen probably had like better reaction in terms of his hands. Like, Jared Allen's hands are unbelievable. That guy catches fucking everything. He's just a little bit more able to like do things with the ball too. Like, Jackson Hayes, like you mentioned, like him, like, you know, doing stuff in transition with the ball occasionally, but like in tight situations, he doesn't, like, he's just never asked to do that stuff. If I remember correctly, he was like 6 foot as a freshman in high school. And then I think he was like 6'6", even as maybe like going into his junior year, even. So this like 6'11 height is new. He was a football player, like you said. Like, he was Archbishop Moeller in Cincinnati, football player, like on track to go like Division I in football, from what I know. And now he's like a 6'11 guy with a 7'5 wingspan, bouncy as shit athletically. I mean, I think his dad's like on a football staff somewhere, isn't he?
I can't remember from that story. I want to say he was affiliated with Cincinnati somehow. I'm not positive. Maybe that's his coach. I can't remember what his affiliation to that was. But yeah, I like his hands a lot too. Like, that's something you noted about Jaren Allen. Yeah. I really like Jackson Hayes' hands. Like, he catches basically everything. Maybe not to the level of Allen, but it's very, very good. It's
well, just kind of a tight end. If I remember correctly, he was like,
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So like, yeah, he's fascinating.
He's just kind of a blank slate to me. When I look at him, I don't see any bad instincts. Like, we have to differentiate him from a guy like Marquise Chris, who was a football player, but you could see really bad instincts on the floor. Like, his foul rate, he just didn't know what to do. Hayes doesn't strike me as that. Like, his reaction time might not be elite, but it's not terrible. Like, he still makes the rotations. He can test shots. It's just a very, very limited role that he's in. Like, he's not asked to do that much. Texas, we've known that with their bigs. They're not really asked to do a ton of passing. You know, he's made some interesting passes to me. I don't know how to evaluate that decision making. Bottom line is, like, what do you really do with this kind of player? Because we haven't seen anybody quite like this. Like, I think he moves well in space for sure. He has lateral agility. I'm not sure if he's a switch guy, but he does move his feet well. And there's a very projectable role for him as like a rim runner type. It just depends on how much time you have to develop someone like that. It's going to take a situation, again, referencing Allen in Brooklyn, some patience. But I do think he's one of the few guys in this class that has legit center size, maybe the only one that has legit center size and length, and that I see some upside with.
Yeah, I had him at like 30, 31, 32 on my board, something like that. I don't know. I mean, like, most NBA like executives were like, yeah, he'll be a first round pick at some point. We'll see like what he wants to do at the end of the year, but like, if he comes out, he probably goes in the first round. Like, I think that an NBA team just is like, sure.
Oh, I totally think he will, because you, again, with him, you actually see the physical tools and the upside. And I do think the teams are going to give credit to the fact that his instincts aren't broken. Like, he seems just like he's new to the game. He's one of those guys where you think you can mold too. It just comes down to, again, you're going to develop this guy over time, and how much time do you want to invest in that? Because he could be a second contract guy, but I do think the upside is there. If you really need a center, I think this is where you go. I don't know where the hell that is in the first round. I don't know how to value him, really, because, again, you have to factor in all these different variables. But I do like a lot of what I see. Going to be really interesting to watch him over the rest of the season, because I watched some games earlier this year against, like, Michigan State. And like, he's still really, really raw. It's just, you want to see every bit of him as far as what he is asked to do in the post, how good his touch is. You know, his free throw shooting is okay. It's a pretty mechanical jumper. But all of those little things NBA teams have to see, and just see how he progresses as he gets more comfortable, because we're dealing with someone who hasn't played a lot of basketball in his career.
Yeah, he just started his first game on the 28th against Texas Arlington. I would imagine that probably continues going forward. He is, yeah, just bizarre player in a lot of ways to still figure out. Not a bizarre player, but like just a very tough player to figure out still. Cole, this is a 2-hour podcast now. Why does this always happen with us? It's too brand. It's too brand for us.
What do you expect at this point? Like, we say we're not going to, but it always ends up happening. We end up talking about Jackson Hayes for, you know, 5-6 minutes.
Oh, my God. Tell the people what you've got going on in your life.
My life is pretty, it's okay. I mean, it's the holidays, man. It's been interesting. I will say I have one complaint, and that I hate when it gets into the 30s in Seattle, and it's there right now, and it's just absolutely, I just can't go outside. I hate it. But As far as content goes, I'm going to have a piece up for the Stepien sometime this week, hopefully later in the week, about touch. Some of the stuff we've talked about on this podcast have some really interesting cases, like De'Aaron Fox, for example, we talked about. I went back and looked at his stats, his runner stats in college, and they're elite. I think I sent you this on Twitter. But I'm going to kind of go deeper into that aspect of the draft. And as always, continue to listen to this podcast.
Yeah, for sure. For me, I'm going to write about Jarrett Culver later this week. I wrote about, by the way, I wrote like a huge thing on Nasir Little, and we didn't even talk about that. Like, I had North Carolina fans, like in my mentions, just like yelling at me for some random reason. a lot of them were like, hey, this is like the most reasonable, rational, like national media thing I've seen on the Nasir Little situation. Then the others were like, Roy is our God. Like, we need, why are you doubting the greatness of Roy Williams, who's won 3 national titles? I'm like, because like these guys should be doubted sometimes. Like, they're, none of them are infallible. Like, I've gone after Kay at some point this year. I've gone after Roy. Like, it's only a matter of time until I go after Bill Self at some point. Like, and I think Bill Self's fucking amazing. I think they're all fucking amazing. So like, this is where we're at in my life right now. Jarrett Culver will be up at some point this week. Go read the thing on Nasir Little and Cam Reddish and just context in general with evaluating NBA prospects. We'll be back later this week. We'll do something else at some point. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.